Okay, I've got the thumbs up. Nate, did you want to say something?
Thank you, Chair Bedoya. This will be discussed as this meeting proceeds, but we are not proceeding today with an official meeting of the Regional Water Board. We don't have a quorum. This will proceed as a staff workshop. No board business will take place at this meeting. It will essentially be run as a staff workshop with less than a quorum of the board members present. The board members that are here may still ask questions of staff or the public. The public may still comment on the items, but it's not an official board meeting. No board action will be taken on the items that are now listed for this workshop today. That's all I have to say right now.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all those online. Apologize for all the time delays, but we had technical issues. I also want to let you know that because of the changes in the flow of the meeting, there may be a break in the afternoon, longer than the usual break. We have had a late change in the meeting format today. This meeting was originally scheduled as a board meeting where a quorum of the board members would be present. However, we recently learned that a quorum of board members could not be here today. Accordingly, we will be conducting this meeting as a staff workshop. Staff will present items 1 through 3 as listed on the revised agenda. The board members present at this workshop will not take formal action on the items discussed. Item 1, the discussion of the Walla TMDL action plan will become a part of the record for that matter, and the board will consider adoption of the action plan at the scheduled February 18th, 19th, 2026 board meeting. This workshop is being webcasted and recorded, so all participants please speak clearly. Members of the public who wish to participate in the workshop may join the meeting at the scheduled physical location or may use the Zoom application to address the board from a remote location. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available at www.cal-span.org. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID and the password you received from the clerk. If you've not already received the meeting ID and the password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/North Coast. Click on the December 4, 2025 board meeting button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with the Zoom login information. For anyone here in the meeting room that wishes to address the board, please complete a speaker card available on the tables outside the boardroom and give it to the clerk. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. The clerk will unmute you when it is your turn to speak. We will call each commenter by name and then unmute each commenter. I would also like to ask those who have provided a contact name, please state your name for the record before you speak. There's the normal 5-minute time limit for each commenter. During public comment, you will see a timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, we will run the timer and let you know when your time is up. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board and staff can hear you when you are called upon during public comment. When you are done speaking and the board members or staff have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item, and then you may choose to exit the meeting. All right, we will move on to the pledge. If you would join me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Yes, someday. Okay, staff will introduce items as they are presented. We will begin with, let's see, Valerie, would you do the introductions, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can introduce staff, and then if it's okay with you, I also had some brief updates that I wanted to share with the board. So I'll start by introducing myself, Executive Officer Valerie Quinto. To my right are Assistant Executive Officers Claudia Villacorta and Josh Curtis. To my left are Counsel to the Board Nathan Jacobson and Bailey Toff Dupuy. And across from me is Deidre Wilkerson, our Administrative Officer. And as you noted, other staff will introduce themselves as they present.
May I stop you there?
Yes.
The board introductions. To my right.
Hi, Jake McKenzie from Runner Park. I guess I'm not here.
Well, I see you.
Alice Hart from Little Shasta.
Hector Bedoya from the Healdsburg area, Sonoma County. And we're missing Greg Giusti. He's ill today. And we are therefore not in quorum. And if there's anybody out there interested in becoming a board member, please, we need your help. Turn it over to Valerie.
Thank you very much, Chair Bedoya. First, I want to say thank you to board members and the public for your patience this morning. As you noted, we've had some last-minute changes to the meeting format, and then we had some IT issues. So really appreciate everyone that's here and your dedication to water quality issues in our region, and hopefully the day will start rolling smoother from here. We shall see. I wanted to provide a couple of updates. The first is that early November, there was an article in the North Bay Business Journal, which is a segment of the Press Democrat. It was speaking to our construction stormwater regulations, and Board Member McKenzie flagged that for me and asked for an update on it. And so this is a great opportunity to highlight our program and also to provide a couple of clarifications to what was shared in that article. So I'll start by sharing, in case you didn't see the article, that it was prompted by a meeting that was held by the Northern California Engineering Contractors Association and the North Coast Builders Exchange. And it was an informational meeting for their members. And our staff were really happy to be invited to present. I understand that our staff have presented at such a meeting over the last few years. It's a really great opportunity to outreach to the regulated community, make sure that folks understand our regulations, how to comply, and also have a face to put to the regulations, someone they feel like they can connect with. So we appreciated the invitation. I'll note that the regional board regulates construction sites over 1 acre through the statewide construction stormwater general permit. So that's a statewide permit that is adopted by the state board, but is administered by the regions. That statewide permit was most recently updated in 2022. We understand that there are still folks having trouble understanding how to fully comply with that permit. And so that meeting held by the Engineering Contractors Association and the Builders Exchange was a great opportunity to help folks understand, how to comply with that permit, and also just, kind of make a plug that we're eager to provide compliance assistance with that permit program. At that meeting, in addition to kind of talking through those requirements of the current statewide permit, our staff also spoke to a couple of recent changes in our inspection program, and those were the things that were kind of the focus of the what was shared about the regional board in that article. So the first thing that our staff member Walt spoke to, Walt Dragolowski, he spoke to a 2020 audit by USEPA. USEPA audits California's Clean Water Act enforcement program every 5 years, and they rotate which region which regions are included in that audit. And so in 2020, our regional board actually wasn't included in the audit, but US EPA did an audit of other regions in California and noted, you know, across the regions, recommendations about adequate documentation of stormwater inspections. And that led the State Water Board to develop guidance, in statewide inspection guidance, which our staff are now following to make sure that we are, you know, correctly performing and documenting inspections on stormwater sites. We normally, we have pretty limited resources to implement this program. And so the other change that Walt talked about in the meeting was some efforts that we're making to maximize our resources on this program. We normally have about 300 sites enrolled in the construction stormwater permit in any given year. Those sites are scattered throughout our region, and we have one staff member who's dedicated to inspecting those sites. The inspection workload is also concentrated in the rainy season and in the months before the rainy season, so that makes it even harder to cover all of the ground that needs to be covered for this program. So to meet those challenges and to provide an opportunity for staff in other programs in our organization to learn about stormwater, our staff conducted an informal training in which about 60 of our staff participated. And the purpose of that training was to enable staff from programs outside the stormwater program to understand how to review sites from the public right-of-way and identify whether those sites merit a full inspection by construction stormwater staff. So it's basically a way of getting more eyes on the ground so that to support our construction stormwater staff so that they can be made aware of sites that need attention. And so that was something that was highlighted in the Press Democrat article. So, you know, I think that's something we're excited about, having a new system to use our limited resources to cover the ground that's out there. We're also...
Is that like a standardized form that staff would fill out when they're on an inspection so that it captures all the data, evidence, imagery, and description of what's going on?
I believe those kind of informal reconnaissance inspections would not be as in-depth as that in terms of collecting a lot of data. It would be more... for our own internal information to flag what needs follow-up by construction stormwater staff. And then, Claudia, can you speak to the statewide inspection guidance?
Good morning. So the drive-by inspections would be done to identify potential discharges from a particular site, but they're not necessarily a compliance inspection of the BMPs that are in place to reduce that discharge that is observed by a particular staff that's driving by that site. So it would be to prioritize compliance inspections and to follow up with a more detailed inspection, which will be done by our construction stormwater inspector, Walt. And the question that you had regarding imagery that would be used, that I would have to see if maybe Charles Reed from our who oversees the divisions of the stormwater program has more information about that. But my understanding is that type of information would be part of a compliance inspection, and in particular if you're also moving forward with some type of enforcement investigation, and it would not be part of a reconnaissance type of inspection. It's not common to that, but if Charles, if you want to add more to that, I'll feel free to do so.
I'm learning. Eventually, I'll get it.
Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. Thanks. I don't really have a lot to add, but what I would like to emphasize is that. These drive-by inspections are really just an effort to have more eyes in the field. They're not going to be conducting full-scale inspections. That's really for the more seasoned stormwater staff to do, to look at all the details of BMPs. But what we want to do is just get more people out there to see the sites. And, you know, to that end, we'd also encourage the public, you know, when they see something at a construction site that looks a little odd, to let us know, and we'll get inspectors out there to look at it. So that's really the goal of this new effort by us, just to get more eyes out in the field.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so I know that our stormwater staff would have loved to be here to also answer questions, but they actually are providing some compliance assistance today and participating in a low-impact development training this morning. But if this is a program that board members are interested in hearing more about, please let me know that at any time, and we can provide a more comprehensive information item. I just wanted to provide the not too brief, but somewhat briefer updates in response to that North Bay Business Journal article.
Mr. Chair, low impact development, LID, I remember that from my days in the Runner Park City Council. And do you have a brief description of what low impact development means in the context of our activities?
Very, very briefly, practices that attenuate the impact of increased runoff from hardened surfaces. So, things like, rain gardens that could infiltrate water or stormwater capture. That's not the precise technical definition, but that's what I've got since our staff aren't here today. And again, if that's something that the board is interested in hearing more about in the future, I can arrange an information item from program staff.
Yeah, certainly developments that took place in the University District in Runner Park, for example, with bioswales. These type of mitigation measures, I think it would be useful at some point in time, if that's something that we're overseeing, that we would be briefed, about which we would be briefed. Thanks a lot.
Thank you
for bringing up this topic, since I'm the one who started this whole thing off. Thank you.
Chair, if I may. Valerie, I would be interested in that informational item where it works. I know we always seem to have busy schedules, except for maybe this meeting or workshop. But in the future, I'd like to see that. Thank you.
And I just wanted to add that Heaven Moore, who is the senior overseeing the stormwater unit, is an expert and has provided training to other municipalities on LID development and design of those, so she would be an excellent person to have as part of that informational item as well. And we're also developing a stormwater enforcement strategy, so we can possibly, if it's done in time, we could possibly pair that informational item with just our general cannabis enforcement strategy moving forward, along with information about LID requirements and stormwater general permits.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. One other update that will be shorter than my stormwater update is I wanted to share with the board the exciting development that earlier this month I signed a memorandum of understanding with CalTrout, CalWild, and Trout Unlimited to establish mutual understandings about our work together on a potential basin plan amendment to designate Cedar and Elder Creeks as outstanding national resource waters. And you may remember outstanding national resource waters as something that you heard about during the triennial review process, and then also saw a brief update about in our August 2025 Executive Officers Report article that provided updates on all of our triennial review projects. The MOU is a significant milestone for the project, which is being led at the regional board by Matt St. John, our climate specialist. The MOU sets an agreement that our NGO partners will develop a draft technical report for the project within 12 months. It describes how we'll work together on the project and also clarifies that any future basin plan amendment will be at the discretion of the regional board.
And Valerie, those creeks, those tributaries are cold water refugia off of the tributaries to the Eel River?
I believe it's the South Fork Eel River, yes. Yeah. Just wanted to share that we're excited about that milestone. We're really enjoying and looking forward to continued work with our partners on this. And we're also looking forward to providing the board an update on the project through an information item in early 2026.
Fantastic. Congratulations, Matt. And thank you, Valerie.
And that's all of my updates. Thank you for making time for them.
Okay, so we go on to public workshops. Public workshop to consider resolution number R1-2025-0055, amending the water quality control plan for the North Coast Region Basin Plan to incorporate the action plan for the Gualala River Sediment TMDL. Dr. Lance Lee.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Bedoya and members of the board. I am Dr. Lance Lay, a water resource control engineer in the Watershed Assessment and Recovery Unit within the Planning and Watershed Stewardship Division of the North Coast Water Board. I'm here today to present the
Is your mic on?
Yes, it is. I can make it closer?
Please.
Better?
All right. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. I'm here today to present the proposed action plan for the Gualala River Sediment TMDL. This was an action item, but now is an information item, preceding the adoption hearing to amend the water quality control plan for the North Coast Region or the Basin Plan to incorporate the action plan for the Gualala River Sediment TMDL. Before we get started, I'd like to orient you to this item's materials. These include the staff summary report, today's presentation slides, including full-size versions of any maps in the presentation, the proposed basin plan amendment, a response to public comments document, and the revised staff report, including the 2001 US EPA established TMDL and the substitute environmental documentation for CEQA. This presentation is structured into five sections. Thank you. The sections comprise a timeline of events and the regulatory background for this action plan, an overview of the sediment TMDL established by US EPA in 2001, an overview of the proposed action plan, a summary of public comments, staff responses, and changes to the draft action plan and draft staff report, and finally, the key takeaways for this presentation. Slides for the first three sections for this presentation were also presented during a workshop at the August board meeting. Some of the slides are identical and unchanged, but they would nevertheless help reorient you and members of the public to this project. On this slide is a timeline of key events related to the Gualala River Sediment TMDL. In 1993, the watershed was listed as impaired due to excessive sedimentation and siltation. This impairment listing was further bolstered by local coho and steelhead salmon populations being listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act in 1996 and 2000, respectively. Also in 1996, a lawsuit was brought forward by Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations and other entities against the State Water Board. The judgment from the lawsuit led to a consent decree, which is a court order that directed US EPA to develop TMDLs for all sediment-impaired water bodies in the North Coast region. The Gualala River watershed was included in this consent decree. North Coast Water Board staff at the time provided scientific and technical support that led to the TMDL established by US EPA in 2001. Following the multiple consent decree TMDLs, the sediment TMDL implementation policy was adopted into the basin plan in 2004. The purpose of the sediment TMDL implementation policy was to serve as the action plan for the TMDLs established during the consent decree. Now fast forward to the 2020s, another lawsuit was brought forward by Friends of the Gualala River against the water boards. This lawsuit was resolved through an agreement with Friends of Gualala River, wherein the North Coast Water Board will develop an action plan for controlling sediment in the Gualala River. Pursuant to this agreement, the North Coast Water Board staff initiated the public process for adopting the Quilala River Action Plan into the Basin Plan with CEQA scoping conducted in 2024. The public review and comment period for the draft action plan and draft staff report ran from July 11th through August 25th, with a public workshop held on August 14th during the public comment period. And now we are currently here for the information item preceding the proposed action plan's adoption. The proposed action plan rests on the following regulations and statutes. Section 303 of the Federal Clean Water Act requires that states identify water bodies that do not meet water quality standards. States must then establish a total maximum daily load, or TMDL, for those impaired water bodies and their pollutants. TMDLs must identify and quantify sources of pollution and provide metrics that indicate progress towards attainment of water quality standards. From the perspective of US EPA and the water boards, this requirement has already been met with the establishment of the sediment TMDL in 2001. With respect to state law, the California Water Code authorizes the North Coast Water Board to develop and adopt implementation plans to address impaired water bodies so that they meet water quality objectives. At a minimum, adopted implementation plans require a description of actions, a schedule, and a monitoring plan. The proposed action plan for the Quilala River Sediment TMDL meets these California Water Code requirements. This distinction between state and federal law is important to highlight because of the multiple TMDLs established by US EPA for the North Coast region. While the TMDL was established in 2001, the action plan itself also contains the US EPA TMDL. For some basic background, the elements of a TMDL as required by the Clean Water Act and federal regulations include a problem statement, which identifies the water body, its characteristics, and the water quality standards being violated due to a pollutant. A source analysis that quantifies the source of pollution, both natural background and anthropogenic. Load and waste load allocations for non-point source and point source pollution, respectively, which assign numeric values to individual sources. These load allocations provide the loading capacity of a water body where, if they are exceeded, water quality standards would be impaired. Targets and indicators, both numeric and narrative, that describe the desired conditions, which would signify the attainment of water quality standards. The load allocations must also consider margin of safety, seasonal variations, and critical conditions, which together characterize the uncertainty and natural variability affecting the source analysis and load allocation estimates. Finally, the TMDL must document public participation showing engagement between the regulatory agency with the public and parties affected by the TMDL. For the next several slides, I will focus on the problem statement, source analysis, load allocations, and targets and indicators. The first part of the problem statement is the watershed setting. The figure to the right shows the Quilala River watershed and its hydrologic subareas. The Quilala River watershed is a coastal watershed found in northern Sonoma and southern Mendocino counties. In 2001, approximately 72% of the watershed was forested lands, with grass and shrublands accounting for most of the remainder. The majority land use in the watershed historically has been timberlands, which comprise about 34% of the watershed, with other economic activities being ranching, vineyards, and mining. Urban development was a very small fraction of the watershed at 2.3%. The problem statement for a TMDL requires identifying the relevant water quality objectives and the beneficial uses that those objectives protect. Water quality objectives may be numeric or narrative, and they provide the basis to judge whether the beneficial uses of water are being supported. The parameters or pollutants relevant for this TMDL include suspended material, settleable material, sediment, and turbidity. For suspended material, settleable material, and sediment, the objectives are narrative. Water bodies shall not contain these pollutants in amounts that cause nuisance or adversely affect beneficial uses. The turbidity objective is partially narrative. Turbidity shall not exceed 20% above natural background levels. Excessive sediment in the Gualala River watershed has impaired the following beneficial uses: cold freshwater habitat, commercial or sport fishing, estuarine habitat, migration of aquatic organisms, and spawning, reproduction, and or early development of aquatic organisms. The source analysis for the 2001 TMDL relied on aerial photography analysis, sampling for field measurements of sediment sources, in-stream surveys, and an assessment of sediment delivery on public and private roads. Data for the source analysis span 1978 to 2000. Specific sediment processes that contribute to pollution include debris slides, debris flows, earth flows, soil creep, gullies, stream crossing washouts and diversions, and road surface erosion and skid trail surface erosion. This slide shows the load allocations and TMDL calculation. The pie chart on the left sums individual sediment sources into the broad categories of natural backgrounds, timber harvest-related sources, and road-related sources. The source analysis found that approximately 31% of sediment comes from natural background, 11% from timber harvest-related activities, and the remainder and majority being road-related sources at 58%. The pie chart on the right shows load allocations. To meet the attainment of water quality standards, the percent reductions needed are 89% for timber harvest-related sources and 85% for road-related sources. The watershed-wide TMDL is the sum of the right pie chart and is equal to natural background times 125%, which equals 475 tons per square mile per year. To meet the load allocation and load reductions, the US EPA TMDL describes various numeric targets and indicators. These targets and indicators serve as guideposts for monitoring and implementation purposes. They are categorized to in-stream and hill slope targets. Hill slope targets are the outcome of source control, that is, through the implementation of permits and other regulatory tools. An example hill slope target is decreasing hydrologic connectivity of roads. In-stream targets are more response-based, which are the eventual consequence of restoration activity and source control. An example of an in-stream target is increased large woody debris. Because sediment pollution in a water body is driven by physical processes, in-stream indicators typically lag hill slope indicators because the time scales to achieve these targets can vary from years to multiple decades. So with the overview of the 2001 TMDL done, I'll move on to an overview of the action plan. The development of the action plan started with the reliance on the existing source analysis, as the technical work and TMDL remain valid today. Specifically, the source analysis is tied to land use and land cover. This figure shows two land cover maps in 2001 and 2022. Aside from increased forest cover, the distribution of land cover has not substantially changed between 2001 and 2022, as timberlands remain the largest land use. The action plan instead focuses on roads and roads-related sediment. This figure shows the percent impervious surface in 2001 and 2022. Impervious surface can be used as a proxy for urban infrastructure development, including roads. Impervious surface had a small increase between 2001 and 2022, indicating that roads remain an issue and a continued source of potential sediment discharge. Since the TMDL's adoption in 2001, there have been activities conducted in the watershed that address the TMDL load reductions. For the North Coast Water Board, these activities include the sediment TMDL implementation policy, which was adopted into the basin plan in 2004. The implementation policy was developed in part to address the consent decree USEPA established TMDLs, including the Gualala River sediment TMDL. The implementation policy directs staff to use existing regulatory authority in issuing permits and enforcement actions, as well as pursuing other non-regulatory actions, such as working with public agencies and nonprofits to develop sediment control strategies. This proposed action plan before you is consistent with the sediment TMDO implementation policy. Other North Coast Water Board activities include the permitting mechanisms and other regulatory actions for timber and road sources. The exact permits adopted will be listed on a later slide. The recently adopted Basin Plan amendment that reorganized and remediated the Basin Plan sections so that they now explicitly reference the US EPA TMDLs and their relationship with the sediment TMDO implementation policies. Other activities in or relevant to the watershed include the improvement and evolution of management practices, sediment control projects for roads on private property in the watershed, and grant-funded restoration and monitoring work. The proposed action plan incorporates directly by reference or summarizes many components of the 2001 TMDL. These existing components include the problem statement, the source analysis, the load allocations, the numeric watershed-wide TMDL, and monitoring for targets and indicators. The main new component not in the 2001 TMDL is the program of implementation. The proposed action plan's program of implementation can be summarized in a brief statement. It relies on existing permits and the development of a roads-focused permit to fill in regulatory gaps. The table on this slide shows all the existing permits as well as the new future permit or orders at the bottom. Each permits row shows the responsible party and their covered activity. The timber harvest waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, and waivers of WDRs on non-federal land address all sediment source categories found on timberlands, both roads-related and harvest-related. The 5-county or 5C waiver covers road-related sediment from county-owned roads. The Caltrans stormwater permit covers state highways and other Caltrans-owned infrastructure. The construction stormwater general permit covers land disturbance, including roads for projects exceeding 1 acre. General water quality certification covers projects adjacent to water bodies. The recently adopted vineyard order covers sediment discharge from roads on commercial vineyard lands. The new permit or orders address the remaining gap of all privately owned roads, including the roads on timberlands not enrolled in timber harvest plans. For complying with the action plan, including all the permits shown on the previous slide, the staff report lists funding sources and assistance organizations, which are repeated here on this slide. Grant funding in particular can vary in focus, funding amounts, and eligibility. They are subject to changes in the funding entity's priorities and are generally more available to organizations versus individual landowners. Private landowners can still seek assistance on road-related projects from resource conservation districts, entities within the North Coast Resource Partnership, and the watershed-wide roads assessment currently funded through the Water Board contracts. These contracts allocate $2 to $3 million for road assessments, and one of these contracts is with the Sonoma Resource Conservation District. This slide documents the extent of North Coast Water Board outreach efforts and public participation in the development of the draft and proposed action plan. CEQA scoping meetings, both virtual and in person, occurred last summer within the watershed. Tribal outreach was conducted to tribal entities per AB 52 requirements on tribal consultation. The public notice for the draft action plan and draft staff report was sent out to 180 recipients via the Gov Delivery email service, and a workshop was held during the public comment period on August 14th of this year. Additionally, staff have engaged with interested parties in the watershed, including tribes, nonprofits, industry, and individual landowners. So while this presentation is an information item, I want to reiterate that the formal public comment period has ended on August 25th of this year. So for the next several slides, I will discuss public comments and staff responses. The North Coast Water Board received 6 public comment letters from the following entities: the California Licensed Foresters Association, the Dorothy King Young Chapter of the California Native Plant Society, an individual named Ava Lopez, Forest Landowners of California, Coahuila Redwood Timber, and the Sonoma County Farm Bureau. Staff grouped the individual comments within those letters into 5 topics related to the TMDL and source analysis, the program of implementation, and the future private rural roads order, peer review, and funding and cost of compliance. The 5th topic contained other comments that were outside the scope of the action plan. Specifically, these comments discuss alleged sediment discharge events. Staff have referred the commenter to the appropriate North Coast Water Board staff in the timber and water quality certification units, as well as to the Water Board's complaint database. The most numerous comments are related to the TMDL and source analysis. Commenters contend that because the TMDL was established over two decades ago, the action plan should be updated with new data, including data from implementation of permits such as the Timber General Waste Discharge Requirements, or GWDRs. Staff responded that a new source analysis would not change the loaded capacity, which is the basis of the TMDL load allocations and load reductions. The loading capacity is tied to beneficial uses and the attainment of water quality standards. Recall that land cover and land use have not changed substantially since 2001, because the TMDL is equal to 125% of natural background. Re-estimating the loads for anthropogenic sources would neither change the load allocations nor the load reductions necessary. The load reductions in the action plan are relative to the anthropogenic loads calculated in 2001. Staff acknowledge that since the TMDL's establishment, permit implementation and other work in the watershed have likely contributed to load reductions. Adopting this action plan does not create a new starting point and does not impose new load reduction targets. Any progress and improvements completed by dischargers and landowners after 2001 will continue to count towards the existing load reduction targets. Most commenters on the program of implementation in the future private rural roads order express concern that this future order has potential to duplicate or conflict with existing permits. Other commenters felt that the program of implementation is too focused on roads versus landslides. Staff responded that the action plan by itself only requires the board to develop a roads order. Development of the future roads order is an active project and will not duplicate existing permits. The future order is intended to fill in gaps not covered by existing permits. The program of implementation's focus on roads is justified, as roads-related sediment is the largest sediment source and directly implicate other sediment discharge processes such as landslides. 2 specific sub-comments were given regarding peer review. One comment contends that Appendix D of the staff report containing this peer review exemption memorandum lacks administrative and scientific credibility. The other sub-comment stated that the action plan's approach to peer review did not consider information gained after the adoption of the timber GWDRs. Staff responded that the peer review exemption memorandum was reviewed and approved by the Water Board's Office of Chief Counsel. The 2001 TMDL and the science underlying it was established through U.S. EPA's process. In addition to this existing science, the action plan relies on existing authority such as the North Coast Water Board's sediment TMDL implementation policy and the State Water Board's non-point source policy. Thus, scientific peer review is not necessary for the action plan. Furthermore, other regional water boards have used the same approach for peer review exemption for their TMDLs. That all said, the draft staff report's version of this memorandum did indeed lack document formatting, such as a letterhead or a signature, which has now been rectified in the revised staff report's Appendix D. The other peer review comment regarding information available after the 2001 TMDL's establishment was responded in a similar manner as the comments related to the TMDL and source analysis, incorporating information gained from the timber GWDRs would not change the load allocations or loading capacity, as they are tied to beneficial uses and calculated from natural background loads. Again, staff acknowledge progress towards necessary percent reduction in anthropogenic loads have likely occurred due to the implementation of the timber GWDRs. Finally, commenters were deeply concerned about the cost of compliance with a future order, such as permit fees and road improvement fee costs. Commenters stated that while the Water Boards has provided funding for road assessments, no specific funding source was provided for implementation. Commenters were further concerned about the uncertainty of federal funding. Although the staff report provides a comprehensive overview of potential funding sources, staff acknowledge that road improvements and road repairs may be costly given the estimates provided in the staff report of comparable projects. While all TMDLs contain a high-level and programmatic overview of costs, this action plan does not impose or define costs. A more detailed cost assessment will be part of the future order development, which will be a board action separate from the adoption of this action plan. Throughout the future order development process, staff and the North Coast Water Board will continue to work with landowners to identify potential funding sources for implementing this future order. In response to public comments and other developments, staff have made the following changes to the action plan and staff report. Both the action plan and staff report have added clarifying statements that the future order will not duplicate coverage from other existing permits or regulations. The general waste discharge requirements for commercial vineyards have been added to the list of existing permits. The commercial vineyard order was not included, was adopted during the action plan's public review and comment period, and could not be included in the draft documents. The staff report Appendix D, or the peer review exemption memorandum, has been replaced with more formal formatting and includes a signature from Nate Jacobson, counsel for the North Coast Water Board. The remaining changes include non-substantive and clarifying editorial edits such as grammar, punctuation, and formatting. In summary, the key takeaways for this presentation are: the action plan implements the US EPA established TMDL and relies on the existing science and technical analyses from that TMDL. The action plan references multiple existing permits that address most anthropogenic loads, most anthropogenic sediment sources, and identifies private rural roads as the remaining gap. The action plan proposes a new order to address this coverage gap, as roads remain the largest anthropogenic sediment source in the watershed. The public comments received covered topics related to the 2001 TMDL, the program of implementation, peer review, and funding. In response to comments related to the 2001 TMDL, staff clarified that the TMDL is based on the loading capacity, which is calculated from natural background estimates, which are further based on land use and land cover. Available remote sensing data shows little change between 2001 and the present. Therefore, a new source analysis would not change the TMDL and the loading capacity. In response to comments related to the program of implementation and peer review, staff have made changes to both the staff report and action plan. These changes include a properly formatted peer review exemption memorandum and statements that address concerns about the future orders, potential conflicts with or duplication of existing permits. Finally, staff acknowledge that compliance costs for the future order could be expensive. Staff commit to working with landowners in both the development of the future order to minimize compliance costs, as well as to assist landowners in identifying funding for implementing the future order. The next steps for this project is to renotice the public hearing date to the February board meeting, update the adopting resolution to reflect the correct date, and holding the adoption hearing in Crescent City, California. On this slide are contact information for this project's team members, including myself, Lisa Bernard, Senior Environmental Scientist and the Planning Unit Supervisor, and Joel Bison, an Environmental Scientist in the Planning Unit. With the presentation concluded, I can answer questions from board members now or after any public comments.
Dr. Lee, thank you so much. I guess the big challenge is funding for
correct
maintenance. Yes. But private properties, I don't know. I'll just shut up. should we take public comment before? Is there anybody listed?
We do have a few folks signed up to provide comment on regarding the TMDL action plan. We have one in person and two on Zoom.
Let's take public comment and then open it up to the board, and then we'll take a break.
Okay, Alan.
Good morning, board, and everybody else that's here.
Good morning.
My name's Alan Levine, and I'm speaking for Coastal Action Group. I want to make it clear that I started this whole TMDL thing, got a consent decree, worked to get the Garcia River TMDL approved, had an agreement with the EPA and the state, where the state was responsible for 9 of 18 TMDLs, of which the Wallala is one. Also got the Elk River Creek in near Eureka returned because it was not done in a fashion that was reasonable and complete and meeting the standards required for TMDL. So I have a huge investment in TMDL, and I believe in them because they work. And when I was working with the regional board and the EPA in the settlement for the consent decree back in, this is 95, I guess, they asked me, what do you want? And I said, I want to fix these rivers. And in my opinion, they work for the Garcia, but what's happening with the other rivers is not good enough because we're relying on programs that really aren't being enforced.
Well, tell me, what do you see happen in the Garcia that isn't happening in other waterways?
Right. So, well, up on the slide here, section 13242 of Water Code, the water quality control plans or action plans, which this is, are you got to describe all actions necessary to attain water quality standards. You have to have an implementation strategy for doing that with timelines, and you have to have monitoring, and that's what's not happening. And in the Garcia, we had programs where every rancher or landowner that of significance had to develop a plan for sediment control on their property. And for the timberlands, we had prescriptive rules beyond the forest practice rules, because the forest practice rules, I don't care what you hear from anybody, they are not fully protective. So the landowners had three choices: go by the prescriptions and develop a plan, or develop a plan those two, develop your own plan, live by the prescriptions, or run naked. And people didn't want to run naked. So they did one or the other. There was a push to get it done. Not everybody was perfect, you know, in compliance, but most were. And we buttoned up about 80% of the watershed sediment sources. And very shortly, we had premium spawning gravels in the lower river. I mean, the TMDL was approved in 2002. I had the major timber company shut down because Cal Fire agreed with me and got on their ass, 24,000 acres, which we now own. But the lower river and the Garcia River is responded rather promptly, and we started seeing fish around 2005 and 2006. That's very short period after the implementation of the TMDL. But we did a good job buttoning up sediment sources. And what I'm saying about this plan, you're relying on a bunch of programs, and they're somewhat effective, but they're not good enough. But a major issue is you have a roads permit, and it's not incorporated in the TMDL. It's not really solidified and approved, you know. It's not there yet. And I don't see how you can approve this TMDL until it is there, because you're relying on an undescribed action. I think I'm loud enough without the thing. So going back, we had the ranch plans, and we had the forestry, and we had the site-specific management plans for forestry that needed to be equal to or better than the prescriptive actions. But they allowed a greater latitude for management for the forest practices, and it worked. In the Wallala, you have Kelly Road. This agency was going to enforce on Kelly Road in 98, and the Army sold it for a buck. And how long is 98 from now? It's like 27 years ago? That is a huge sediment source, not addressed, because the board was reluctant to deal with the owner of the road that bought it for a dollar and has been not managing it up to the standards necessary. That is probably the biggest single sediment source in the whole watershed, and just let it go for 27 years. I mean, the EMTs can't even park their trucks out there on emergencies because they can't get them started again. There's so much slush and slurry, fine sediment on top of the roads. If you're on a hill, you'll never get the ambulance rolling again. There's a lot of sediment produced by that road. So the final part of my comment is I'm a little bit upset in the sense that I made comments and they didn't show up in the comment and response. I have emails to prove it. I said, these are my comments. Consider this comments on the plan. And what I want to leave you with is that there's this more work that needs to be done before you approve this. Because I want to get this thing fixed. I've been working on the Wallala since mid-80s. That's a long time from now. And I'm tired and old.
I greatly respect the institutional knowledge that you bring, and I'd like you to speak with staff directly and help them flesh this thing out.
Well, I did have a meeting with staff. I asked for a meeting with Jonathan, and that hasn't happened yet. And I also want you to know that I am working to get more timber staff that should be being funded on AB 1492. The staff is not being adequately funded on that timber yield tax fund. The money is there, and I'm hoping to get some more legislation through or some help with getting more staff people for that. And I have in the past, but somehow there was attrition in the staff. And the same for Fish and Wildlife as well. There's horrible, not horrible, but there's a significant lack in capability of being out on the ground. You cannot, part of making this work is having boots on the ground and seeing what is really going on. You have the load analysis. It shows that you need an 80% reduction, but where? You got to find the sources, and that requires road assessments on the mass scale. On the Garcia, just on the South Fork, we replaced like 390 culverts and two bridges took out all the mid-slope roads, put them to bed. That was probably maybe 15% of the watershed. But you just got to work bit by bit and get something done. I want to see something accomplished. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I provide a very brief response and also ask you a follow-up question about your comment?
Absolutely.
Okay. So my brief response is to say that we take the assertion that there were written comments that were ignored, we take that very seriously. And so our staff will, I saw looks of surprise in our staff's eyes, and I interpreted that as not being aware of these comments. And so our staff will definitely work with Mr. Levine and will, and if there were written comments received during the public comment period on the TMDL, we will absolutely address those as required.
Thank you.
And then the clarifying question I wanted to ask was I heard you ask Mr. Levine to work with our staff to flesh this out, and are you referring to work with our staff on the details of the roads order, or are you suggesting that changes might be needed for the TMDL before adoption?
I'm suggesting that his comments be made in person. If there's a meeting to be scheduled, if they did not receive his comments during the public comment, I'm asking Mr. Levine to provide them.
Okay, thank you.
So that is understood.
Yeah, their emails, they have, if you review your emails, they're there, please.
Alan, could you come to the microphone, please? So there's a communication gap, and I'd like to close that gap. Yeah. And that's my comment, or the substance of my comment.
Yeah, I'm aware of emails from you, Mr. Levine. I'm aware of emails and aware of a meeting that you had with our staff. I'm not aware of written comments on the TMDL being received during the public comment period on that TMDL. And so I think that's what we need to sort out, is if there were written comments received during the public comment period, those are the comments that need to be responded to in writing during the TMDL process.
Yeah, I submitted a litany of issues and comments behind those issues, and I asked for them to be included as public comments to this TMDL. And I'm pretty sure that you have copies of that.
I do have copies of emails from you. I'm not. I think we'll need to offline outside this meeting. We'll need to sort out whether those comments fall into the category of something that is responded to during the public comment period on the TMDL.
Additionally, we had in-person meeting, mm-hmm. and I made issues clear there. Those should be considered as the notes were taken. Yeah,
I know that our staff. Really, I heard about that meeting. I know that our staff and I really valued your time in having that conversation and valued the input that you provided. But we don't respond to those comments in the same way as we respond to written comments. So our staff certainly heard your input and considered it, but it wouldn't be responded to in writing the way written comments received during the public comment period are responded to in writing.
Okay, I can hear that, but there are written comments and I believe that I captured them by saying I'd like these to be considered comments to the TMDL.
Okay, well, we will definitely follow up on that, both by looking at our written records and following up with you.
Right. I'll go look at mine, too.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, we can move to the Zoom commenters now. First up, we have Craig. Craig, I see you have your hand raised. Can you unmute and state your name to make sure we can hear you?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me?
AGP, can you hear him? It shows that he's talking, but I don't hear anything.
Can you hear me?
Craig's technically down.
Yeah, now we can hear.
Hello.
Oh, great, Craig. We can hear you now.
Okay. My name is Craig Bell. I have been working on TMDLs for over 30 years alongside Alan Levine and independently. And I have worked for the Mendocino RCD, helping landowners implement sediment reduction plans. I have worked independently as a restoration contractor, and I have worked in all facets of the TMDL and the Garcia. And I reinforce Alan Levine's comments. We are seeing tremendous improvement of the spawning gravels in the lower 10 miles of the Garcia River due to sediment reduction. And those are physical responses, biological responses. We are now seeing Chinook spawn, Chinook salmon spawn in the lower 8 miles of the Garcia that were missing for 50 years. We have steelhead quality, high quality steelhead spawning gravels all the way to the estuary. It used to be sand and mud when I moved, started fishing the Garcia in 79. And I've worked 25 years as a fishing guide on the river, so I have seen it all. I have to protest. I was not notified about this meeting until 5:30 last night, even though I have consistently said I want to be notified of any and all meetings regarding the Gualala TMDL. So I want to register that complaint. The TMDL needs timelines that need to be met. And without timelines, people tend to drag their feet and think it's business as usual. I strongly support Alan Levine's comments. I have met extensively with your staff in meetings with Alan Levine and my own meetings with your staff and provided really detailed comments on what a functioning TMDL needs to have to make changes on the ground in our lifetimes, not geologic times. And I can say that the failure as a former logger, I can say that it is the failure of the forest practice rules that largely has gotten us here. How do I know? I was paid to rebuild roads that I built poorly under the forest practice rules in the Garcia River, in the South Fork Garcia. We went in and did all that work that was done under the forest practice rules poorly. We redid it all because I was part of the Trout Unlimited North Coast Coho project, and that was our pilot project, redoing the failures of the forest practice rules. There is considerable question whether the waste discharge requirements for timber are adequate, and there are many people who can provide testimony on that. And yes, roads need to be the main focus. I totally agree with that. And again, I want to make sure that this TMDL has timelines that have to be met. I recall a meeting with Mark Rentz, the former attorney for the California Forestry Association, after a meeting with Thomas Westlow, Cal Trout. It was a regulatory hearing, and he said to us, if during a regulatory process, if there are not timelines that have to be met, we win. There needs to be timelines for people to carry out their sediment reduction. I have helped landowners get funding, writing grants. There is a lot of grant money out there for this purpose. There always has been. Yes, the Sonoma RCD Smart Land Planning Program is an excellent medium, 319H fish and game restoration funds and others. So I've always been an ally of the Water Board staff, and I want to continue to be. Thank you very much.
Craig, thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
We do have one other person that signed up, but they're not online. But just to confirm, Dane and Jamie, if you would like to comment on this item, please raise your hand. I do have you down for your other items. Nope, looks like that's it.
All right, well, let's open it up to the board. Any questions?
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm somewhat nonplussed by this whole process. I gather from the presentation that the monitoring data in the Gualala watershed was gathered prior to 2001. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
A considerable amount of Lisa Bernard of your staff.
Right.
Thank you for your question. A considerable amount of infield work and data was assessed by our staff in support of the technical support document that EPA relied upon to establish the TMDL. So that data set was from 1978, I believe, to 2001.
That's 25 years ago. And in the meantime, there have been some regulatory impacts, presumably, on sediment load into the Gualala watershed. And do we have data that's been accumulated over the past 25 years that has had any discernible impact on the problem that we're trying to address?
Yes, data was collected by the Gualala River Watershed Council. They collected in-stream data from 2001 to 2022. We did analyze that data as part of the staff report, I think with one of the appendices. The findings from that data assessment was that the data, the number of monitoring locations wasn't spread wide enough to provide any conclusive statements about the health of the watershed. I think that's the main issue, is that the data collected were not spatially distributed.
But we did, I think, didn't we see some potential indication that in the lower watershed there might be some improvements? It's just not statistically robust.
Correct. There were some certain stations that have, for example, increasing D50 or median particle size. So that means that the sediment is becoming coarser. Some stations have that signal, other stations don't. There's a disagreement between the stations. So we can't really make any conclusions from the number of stations having different results.
Okay. Thank you for that. I just have another comment to make, Mr. Chair, and that's obviously got to do with the status of this board and the fact that we're not able to take action today and we meet in 2 months' time and presumably go through this whole process all over again. Is that correct?
The adoption hearing will include all of the elements of an adoption hearing: a staff presentation, opportunity for public comment, and board discussion and potential action. So one reason we decided to continue with this workshop here in Santa Rosa is that our February meeting is going to be in Crescent City, and according to our settlement, this TMDL needs to go before the board for adoption by February. And so we wanted to continue to provide this local opportunity for local folks to be able to hear the presentation, participate in person. I can consult with the chair on this. My expectation is that at the adoption hearing, we may give a shorter presentation because board and public have already had the opportunity to hear this presentation. It will be recorded and available for viewing, but there will still be some manner of staff presentation that provides the key information, the recommendation for adoption, and an opportunity for additional public comment if there are folks that want to comment again or that didn't comment at this meeting.
No, I understand all that. Believe me, I've been staff and have been in different positions and over my career. But what really frustrates me, and I've said this before publicly and I'll say it again, is the lack of responsiveness from the governor's appointment secretariat for this board to have full membership. And it's just, to me, it's just added to the complexity of what we have heard. I mean, this has been going on for over two decades. I also find that as a new member of a relatively new member of the board, frustrating that it's taken us so long to get to this point. But in any event, I've said enough, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
And I can just briefly respond that I am communicating the challenges posed by our board's bare quorum to all appropriate parties within the administration.
Jake, thank you for your comments and concerns. And yeah, it is the way things are, but hopefully they will improve.
Make me any happier.
Oh well, have a piece of candy.
The only comment I'm going to make is I'm the quiet supporter of Board Member McKenzie today, but my exhaustion is getting the better of me. But I back up Board Member McKenzie.
Well, so do I. But I really appreciate Alan's comments and we'll clarify that, Alan. Thank you, and thank you for the historical references to all your work on the North Coast and continued work. If there's no more comments on this item, we'll take a 10-minute break, 10-15-minute break, and resume at 10 till. We move on to an introduction to a basin plan amendment to address water quality impacts associated with changes in hydrology. Our presenter is Brian McFadden.
Sorry, it looked like it was on. I was just saying good morning. For the record, I'm Brian McFadden, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer on your staff. And I'm here today to present what's now item two, introduction to a basin plan amendment to address water quality impacts associated with changes in hydrology. This project had previously been known as the narrative flow objective. And for reasons I'll explain, we're not calling it that anymore. Sure. I also want to point out this is a triennial review project, I'll get into that a little bit more, too. Before I jump in, I want to acknowledge that while I'm the project lead on this project, I'm supported by a project team, which includes, sort of an all-star cast of our staff and basin planners. And we've also been supported by our state water board partners in our discussions about this item, and I'll get into that as well. The presentation I'll give today covers some of the history and background and context related to this matter, and I'll then begin talking about the progress and status, where we're at with this project, before talking about the timeline moving forward, and then opening it up for discussion. But before I get there, I want to jump to the bottom line, cut to the chase. What I'm going to tell you today and present is that after careful consideration, your staff, our team, has determined that the best course of action at this point is to put forward a basin plan amendment that doesn't include a narrative water quality objective for flow. And instead, we're moving forward with a basin plan amendment that establishes policies and prohibitions to address the water quality impacts associated with changes in hydrology. This is the program of implementation that we've developed for implementing the objective or an objective. And we believe this is the best approach at this time to implement our authorities in a way that will have the most direct and immediate improvements in water quality. So to give you some of the history on this topic, it's sort of a long history. Water quality and quantity issues were first identified, at least in my time, which goes back over 25 years, were first identified in the TMDL process, and most notably in the Scott and Shasta TMDL process. But it also came up to some degree in the Mottola and Navarro TMDLs. And that led us to addressing some of those issues, or partially addressing those issues, as it relates to temperature through our North Coast temperature policy. We engaged with the state board back then when we were doing the Scott and Shasta TMDLs, and were advised at that time that it was probably most prudent for us to go forward with developing flow objectives through our basin plan amendment process due to the constraints on their resources at the time. And so accordingly, flow objectives were identified in the triennial reviews. First, as numeric water quality objectives for flow, and then later narrative water quality objectives for flow. And I'll explain the reasoning around that in a moment. But first, I want to acknowledge that the landscape in terms of in-stream flows and administration of water rights in the North Coast has changed dramatically since the time when we first approached the State Board. The Division of Water Rights and State Board has engaged on North Coast flow issues in a really big way in the intervening time. This is a list of actions that they've promulgated or been involved with since that time. And the North Coast in-stream flow policy was a big one. It addresses the permitting and licensing of water rights in the vineyard growing region of our region and the San Francisco Bay region. Not long after that, the frost protection regulations that address the use of surface waters for frost protection of vines was developed. It's pretty a landmark decision that called out waste and unreasonable use authorities. Then we got into some droughts, and in 2014, State Water Board adopted the Russian River Tributary Emergency Regulations. And then not long after that, Governor Brown established the California Water Action Plan that directed the State Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife to address in-stream flow issues in 5 watersheds throughout the state. 3 of those watersheds are in the North Coast region. Those are the Shasta, the South Fork Eel, and Mark West Creek. Flow issues were a big part of the cannabis policies and permits that implemented that policy. And then we got into another drought, and there was a lot of activity and work around drought response and curtailments. Curtailments were established. To my knowledge, it was the first curtailment since the 77 drought, but I could be wrong about that. But at any rate, curtailments were established in Scott, Shasta, Eel, and Russian watersheds. Another significant effort that the State Board's been involved in and supported is the California Environmental Flows Framework. And while that's not a North Coast specific action, it's a statewide a framework that would be applicable statewide. It's been used and implemented in some instances in the North Coast since its development. The State Board supported the development of that. I want to be clear, they have not formally adopted that framework. And then the Scott and Shasta flow regulations are something that they've been involved with since 2021, first as emergency regulations, and now they're in the process of developing longer-term regulations. And another effort, before I turn to the last effort, I do want to point out your staff has been involved to greater or lesser degrees in all of these efforts, supporting the division and working to share our perspective on the issues in the watersheds that these relate to. And we've done that consistently, and that's been effective, I think. It hasn't been just the State Board. We've been a partner with them. Their most recent effort is what they're calling the supply and demand assessment process. And this is an effort to quantify water availability and compare that to the water rights on the books. The figure on the right is from a flyer from their supply and demand assessment literature. And there's a lot going on there. Let me explain it, because I think it's really indicative of the increased involvement in the North Coast. So the watersheds in the light gray were watersheds that were considered for the supply and demand assessment process. The watersheds in green are those that were selected. And I'll also note that since that time, some of that those watersheds have been expanded, most notably the Trinity. What you see there is the South Fork Trinity, and they've expanded it to the whole Trinity River watershed. The watersheds in blue and red were not considered for the supply and demand assessment process because the State Board was already engaged in analogous processes in those watersheds, and so those were taken off the table because they were already working on that. Taken as a whole, though, you can see that there's a real focus on North Coast in-stream flow issues by the State Board. Now, turning the page and talking about some of the history of what we've been involved with, you know, I mentioned that first we began going down this road with the triennial review, identifying numeric water quality objectives for flow, and we began pursuing that first in the Navarro River, contracted with some firms to develop the Navarro Watershed In-Stream Flow Needs Study Plan, which is a study plan to identify to chart out the process of identifying flow needs that would be the basis of a numeric water quality objective for flow. And after completing that process of the study plan, the takeaway from us was that developing numeric flow objectives on a watershed-by-watershed basis really didn't make sense. It's a process that takes a long time and costs a lot of money. And instead, we wanted to take an approach that could be used to affect our whole region. And so we shifted to the regional narrative water quality objective approach. I want to also point out, though, that that work was not all for naught, and that since that time, the State Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife have implemented portions of the plan. So that's gratifying to me. Some progress. But we really want to make progress on a broader scale than that. Another project that we've been pushing and, sort of been pioneering is another numeric criteria development process, and that is developing the science that quantifies the relationship between dissolved oxygen and the depth of water in riffles, which of course is related to flow. It's an approach for linking stream flow to water quality, which is sort of the holy grail for us. And on the in the figure on the right, you'll see that there's a pretty good relationship there that that's shown. And let me just explain that. So on the x-axis, we have riffle crest thalweg depth. Riffle crest thalweg is sort of a mouthful, but suffice to say, it's a repeatable measurement of depth in riffles between pools. And on the y-axis, we have dissolved oxygen concentration. And what the chart shows is that dissolved oxygen concentrations are stable up to a point. You get to a threshold where the depth decreases to a point that doesn't support dissolved oxygen concentrations in compliance with our water quality objectives. And there's a threshold there. And so we have supported investigators at UC Berkeley to develop this science and publish the work, and that work is currently been submitted for publication. So now let's talk about this Basin Plan Amendment. The progress to date, we've drafted the Basin Plan language, or some Basin Plan language, that included a narrative flow objective and supporting language around that, as well as policies, policy statements, and prohibitions that would be the implementation program for an objective. We also drafted an internal staff report that supports that basin plan language, and use that as the basis for what I'm calling robust discussions of the basin plan language with our internal partners, which includes our own staff, program staff that would be affected, as well as State Water Board staff. Those discussions have led us to conclude that there's a need for a change in approach. The Water Code in Port of Cologne states that when we adopt a new water quality objective, we also have to adopt a program of implementation that implements the objective. And what we're moving forward with now is just that program of implementation. The reasoning for this change in approach is some concerns about how the objective would be implemented. And that relates to, you know, our better understanding of water rights complexity and the limits of our authority. And much of that was a deeper understanding was gained from feedback with the State Water Board regarding what is and isn't helpful to them in administering their water rights process. And so, as I said before, the focus on implementation tools allows us to get to a point where we have actionable tools that we can use using regional water board authorities. So that leads to policies and prohibitions, and I want to discuss those in the next slides. You'll recall that policies establish and describe the board's intent and direction. They are helpful in facilitating use of permits to establish terms and conditions that address the water quantity factors that affect water quality. And importantly, for this case, they're a means of us identifying controllable water quality factors that are associated with discharges of waste so that we can better leverage our permitting programs to address those factors. Port of Cologne Water Quality Control Act gives us the authority to, the mandate to permit discharges of waste and the contents of the water quality control plans. Of course, the basin plan is one of those. And so by establishing these policies, like I said, it gives us leverage in the permitting process for these controllable water quality factors. an example of a policy that I want to highlight is the temperature policy. So the temperature policy identifies stream shade as a controllable water quality factor that we need to address in our permitting processes and other processes in order to implement our temperature objective. Stream shade, or the corollary, excess sun, is not a discharge of waste. It is a controllable water quality factor associated with activities that discharge waste. And so by bringing that into the basin plan, it gives us a better opportunity for addressing that controllable water quality factor, stream shade, through our permits. So what we're moving forward with is analogous to that. Prohibitions guide permit terms and conditions. Permits have to acknowledge prohibitions and establish those terms and conditions that implement them. But importantly, they also provide us with tools to address water quality impacts when we don't have a permit through the use of our enforcement authority, which may include cleanup and abatement orders, could include a cease and desist, or it might include a request for information associated with the discharge. And so examples of that are the seasonal discharge prohibition, which is sort of one of our bedrocks of water quality protection in the region, and more recently, the Russian River fecal waste discharge prohibition. Our approach is to address the impacts on hydrology and flows, not addressed through water rights, to be a companion piece to the water rights process, and to address those controllable water quality factors that are associated with discharges of waste I mentioned previously. And so we've drafted a number of policies that we will be putting forward to peer review, and we expect to be presenting to you at a later date for consideration for adoption. I want to emphasize these are in draft form, and things can change, particularly when we consider peer review comments, public comments, and of course the board's comments. And so with that caveat, I'll just explain we have drafted a policy on restoring and maintaining hydrologic function, which addresses things like wetland and floodplain connectivity, and in some cases groundwater recharge, where groundwater is in connection with surface waters. Also, a policy statement on the impacts of vegetation management on in-stream flows. And so this is a statement. It reflects what the science is very clear on, which is that vegetation management on a large scale can really impact in-stream flows, and particularly the age of vegetation. This, though, is not something that we envision establishing requirements. It's simply an acknowledgement, and so more in the category of should rather than shall. But it's such an important factor. It's worthy of acknowledging and putting in the basin plan, because the basin plan has greater reach than just our own implementation. We've also drafted a policy on hydromodification and runoff management. And, you know, we tend to think of in-stream flow issues that affect water quality as being those associated with diversions and not enough water, but sometimes it's about too much water and the way that runoff is handled. We address this on a routine basis through our stormwater permits that address municipal construction and industrial discharges of excess runoff. But there are other activities that create this excess runoff and result in hydromodification impacts that we think need to be addressed. And so we've drafted a policy that would help us do that and address things like soil compaction and impervious surfaces, routing of runoff, et cetera. And then finally, we've drafted a policy on water conservation to address things like efficient infrastructure and capturing runoff and reusing water, that sort of thing. The other part of this is the prohibitions. And I want to start by saying we have two primary mechanisms for implementing water quality objectives and regulating discharges of waste. Those are permits and prohibitions. The benefit of a prohibition is that we don't have to have a permit in place in order to address something. So it gives us an ability to act without having to go through a permit development process. And what we've drafted are conditional prohibitions, which call for a number of or identify a number of different ways that the prohibition can be complied with. So the first and foremost is any applicable permit that addresses it. Of course, ceasing the discharge and the associated controllable water quality factor would be a way of addressing it. And then finally, development of a plan to eliminate or minimize the discharge and the impacts of the controllable water quality factor is the third option. And in this way, this prohibition can be used in such a manner that it gets us into the same sort of conversation and relationship that we get into with permits without having to go through a permit development process. And the reason why that's important is while we have permits for many activities, vineyards, dairies, timber construction or timber activities, etc., we don't have a permit that covers everything. And these impacts are things that come up in a wide range of activities. And so having a prohibition as a tool allows us to be nimble in that way. I'll also give myself a plug. If for anybody who's interested in learning a little bit more about prohibitions and the way that we're thinking about it here, I authored an article in the August 2025 Executive Officer Summary Report that talks about prohibitions and the power of the Basin Plan. And so if anybody's interested in diving deeper into this, going to our website page that has the agenda for the August 2025 meeting will get you there. The draft prohibitions that we the prohibitions we've drafted and we have under consideration are a prohibition that addresses the hydrologic function and accompanies the policy on hydrologic function, and a tailwater discharge prohibition. Tailwater is one of those issues. You know, we're talking about irrigation tailwater, that the excess water applied for irrigation that returns to a stream. It's one of those issues that is squarely under our discharge of waste authority, but it has a lot to do with water conservation and efficiency. And I'll mention that the Scott and Shasta WDRs are contemplating an approach to dealing with tailwater. And that would be a preview for those interested. Our timeline for moving forward is expressed here, and I mentioned that we developed the Water Board's internal review draft that happened this fall. We've gotten a lot of comments and feedback to consider, which resulted in this pivotive approach. And so we will need to go back and modify the staff report and basin plan language that we've drafted so that we can submit that for peer review this summer. And then following the peer review process and addressing those peer review comments, we expect to put out a public review draft and have a board workshop in the spring or summer of 2027, which would put us on course for board adoption hearing in the spring or summer of 2028. You know, I'm a little vague there saying spring or summer. That's because, you know, we have to give allowances for what comments we may receive or, you know, the content that we don't know will come from peer reviewers and the public. And so that's the reason for the vagueness there. And with that, I'm wrapping up my presentation. Would be happy to answer any questions and look forward to your discussion.
Well, Brian, my hat's to you and your team for your resilience in spite of all the changes in political winds, and I appreciate all your hard work and dedication, and keep going strong.
Thank you.
Are there commenters in the audience or online?
We have one commenter on Zoom.
I'd like to hear them.
Hi, Jamie. Can you unmute and state your name to make sure we can hear you?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Jamie Neary, and I am Policy Director and Staff Attorney for Russian River Keeper. First off, thank you, Brian, for your presentation today and helping us kind of better understand where this new path is going. As you're aware, and we've presented comments on this before, we've been following this issue in its original form, a narrative water quality objective for flow, for several years now. And while we do understand the sensitivities and various complexities around this issue and why the board is now changing its approach on this issue, we do remain concerned that the additional delays that this is going to have, and this is just more so speaking to the history of this item, especially since the 2023 triennial review is already more than a year behind when this change is being made. The 2023 review is not the first time this was identified in the work plan, and it's been ongoing for several years, as Brian mentioned. I think he said 25 years, at least in some form, maybe not this exact form. And the new timeline adds another 2 years, which is, there's just a lot that can happen in that time. And so we just remain concerned that there's going to be additional delays on this issue, despite that history. We don't know what's coming. And so we just kind of urge that there be additional, be it like progress updates, workshops, like to kind of help the public understand that things are moving forward on this issue, and making sure that we don't end up 5 years down the road and we're still having this conversation. I don't think anyone here wants to be in that position, but if there's anything that can be done to kind of help address that potential, that would be really appreciated and helpful. And then we are still kind of wrapping our heads around this change in of itself and whether or not or how it kind of connects to the original goals of the narrative flow objective in effect. And so because of that, we just ask that, again, like there's more like written materials or workshops or, again, like more progress status along the way, to kind of help us and the public understand how this is going to be benefiting our water quality and beneficial uses. And so, yeah, those are our comments today. And again, thank you for the presentation and looking forward to learning more about this. Thank you.
Anyone else?
No, that's it.
Valerie, did you want to chime in?
I just wanted to express appreciation for Jamie's comments and note that the schedule that Brian provided on the slide was a really high level summary, and that we do have considerable public outreach and board interaction planned for this project. We'll also, you know, take another look at that in light of Jamie's comments and make sure that we're, you know, that we're really meeting those goals. And we'll also welcome board member feedback throughout the process, because we do, this project's a big deal for our region, and we do want to make sure that everyone who's interested is aware of what's happening with it.
Thank you, Valerie. Well, let's open it up to board discussion.
I also just wanted to note, while the board is discussing, that we have a representative from State Water Board, Division of Water Quality and Division of Water Rights on Zoom. So if you do have questions that involve them, they're available. I don't believe they're planning to actually make their own comments on this, but they're available if board members have questions.
Thank you. Board members.
Neither do I, but thank you, Jamie, for your comments. I know the board really appreciates it.
Thank you, sir. I don't have any comments.
All right. Well, thank you.
So our next presenter arrives about 3:30.
Yes, unless he's our next presenter is flying into Santa Rosa, and so I'm unless anything changes with his flight, I'm confident he'll be here by 3:30. He could be here before that, but for certainty, I think it would be safe to say that we'll reconvene for that information item at 3:30 p.m.
Okay, so we will break for lunch now, and reconvene. Let's shoot for 3:15, just in case. Okay, we have the thumbs up, and we will resume with item number 3, an overview of grant and loan programs from the Water Board's Division of Financial Assistance. Joe Karkowski, Division of Financial Assistance. Take it away, Joe.
Okay, well, I can just give a brief introduction.
Please.
To this item. Good afternoon, board members and staff, and our partner Joe from Division of Financial Assistance. Thanks for coming back this afternoon. Also want to welcome any of our wastewater facilities that are tuned in online to learn more about grant and loan programs. In short, I know that our board members are always really interested to hear what kinds of financial support the water boards can bring to the table, particularly when we have small disadvantaged communities that are experiencing challenges with their water systems. And we have many, many disadvantaged communities in our region. So our partnership with the State Water Board's Division of Financial Assistance has been a really fruitful one for the regional board and even more so for the communities that we serve. And so really pleased to have Joe Karkowski here today to share with the board and public about those grant and loan programs that are administered by the division, and so I will hand it off to Joe to give that information, and then we also have Charles Reed here, who's the division supervisor for our point source and groundwater protection division, who will provide some closing remarks about his impressive history working on the regional board side in partnership with DFA. So that's our plan for the afternoon.
All right.
And at some point, I'd like some guidance, explanation, clarification, guidance to those municipalities that might need assistance and how they can get started in the process. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I also forgot to mention, just so you're aware, Mr. Chair, that we do have a few folks signed up on Zoom to comment on this informational item. All regulated facilities in our region. So we'll get to them on Zoom later on.
All right. Terrific. Well, thank you for inviting me, Valerie and Chair. Board members, good to see you. Let's see, oh, there it is, good. I needed my teleprompter there, so thank you. So again, I'm Joe Karkowski. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Financial Assistance. been with the division for about 10 years, and before that I was at the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board. So I've been in that position as both a regulator, and now I get to do the fun stuff and hand out money to people. So, but we don't always say yes, so I'll go over those times when we can say yes. And I'll talk about, I know you all have been a bit involved in some of the drinking water issues in your region as well as the clean water issues. So I'll touch on drinking water a bit, talk about our clean water and some of our other programs. If we have some time, I'll touch on a few project highlights from your region. I think the board members have copies of some spreadsheets my team put together on projects that are either currently being funded by us for planning or construction under technical assistance or have pending applications. So Mr. Cherry asked how folks can get funding. So this is kind of a general overview of the process. So a couple of things I'll just say right up front, kind of take-home messages. One is we have a continuous application process. So it's not dependent on, you know, whether Prop 4 or, you know, we get a general fund appropriation or federal funding. We don't create separate application processes. So we have a single application process. Basically, our team then on the back end figures out the best funding package for a particular project. So right now, there's a lot of funding available. I'll go over some of the numbers. You'll see a breakdown of that. That's kind of a point in time situation. It's not necessarily long term. So we've received a lot of funding from the federal government through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act that was passed in 2021. Of course, Prop 4 was just passed. We had some funding from when we had a general fund surplus. But that funding is episodic. So it's nothing we can count on longer term. We have a lot of demand, especially on the small community wastewater side. So I would anticipate within a couple of years, we'll probably have committed most of our grant funding that we have available. And that's based on what we see in the hopper as well as how much we have. Now the programs where we do have more certain funding include our Clean Water State Revolving Fund Loan Program and our Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Loan Program. So those are managed in perpetuity. So we have about $600 million of capacity on the clean water side and about $300 million on the drinking water side. There's also the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund that's been reauthorized now through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, so about $130 million a year through 2045. And then our Underground Storage Tank Cleanup Fund also gets a pretty steady amount of funding. It's based on the revenue from the fuel storage fee. Oh, here. Let me go through the funding process real quickly. So, go ahead. Well, the mood feels great to me. So, yeah, the lighting's perfect. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and feel free to ask those kind of questions or any others as I'm going through. I'm happy to stop and pause. But you had asked a question about the process. So in general, as I said, we have one application. It has four different packages. So there's a technical, you know, so what is the proposed project? Environmental, essentially going through CEQA, sometimes through NEPA and other federal requirements. There's a financial package. So for those folks getting loan, they have to show the ability to repay the loan. Even for those folks getting grant, they have to show the ability to operate and maintain the system. And then we have a general package that is just kind of the overview of what the project is. So we evaluate all of those, our staff does. This is a very simplified view of it. We'll come to, if they qualify for funding, there'll be an initial funding agreement based on the estimated cost for that scope. The system will go through any further design in their procurement, and then we'll have a finalized agreement. So a lot of times folks come back, costs go up, and if we're able to, we can provide that additional funding for them after they've gone out to bid. Then they go into construction after, you know, going out to bid, issuing the notice to proceed, and then we have kind of a final inspection and closeout. So, of course, a lot of this is over many years, but that gives you kind of an overview of the process. Okay. So on the drinking water side, there are a lot of different kind of eligible project types for public water systems, treatment, distribution, source capacity. We're also able to fund individual households in some cases. Like we've had a big focus on domestic wells that, especially during the drought where they ran out of water. So we had programs to support those households, primarily in the Central Valley where the biggest impacts were. We provide... We provide technical assistance, primarily for small disadvantaged communities. We do have the ability to provide some operation and maintenance subsidies, so we have a pilot program doing that. On the drinking water side, we're able to appoint administrators to failing water systems, so we have funding to support those administrators. So the eligible recipients, primarily we focus on public water systems, community water systems, and the non-transient, non-community water systems are mostly schools. So there's not like people don't live at a school, but of course that's a sensitive population. So we support schools as well. So we'll fund nonprofit organizations. A lot of times that's our technical assistance providers, our nonprofits, and we can fund tribes as well. So the funding types, as I said, we have loans, repayable loans. They're low-interest loans, so they're generally half of the state's general obligation bond rate, which is like around a little less than 2% right now, is half of the GO bond rate. And then we have grants for small, primarily economically disadvantaged communities.
A question?
Yeah, sure.
In our region of the North Coast, have you engaged in helping finance tribal organizations?
Yeah, so I don't have all of them like up at the top of my head, but I know we have funded like the Yurok tribe for an SRF loan, which was a number of years ago. I believe one of the tribes we're working with now is also in the North Coast where they're trying to get a state revolving fund loan. But that list will tell you. I think there are a number of tribes that we've identified on that we're currently working with, either technical assistance on the drinking water side or the clean water side. Yep. Yeah, sure.
Is there a mechanism that you guys use to contact tribal organizations, an outreach program directed towards the tribes?
Yeah. The state board does have a tribal liaison, so they do get the word out, and we also have a California funding coordinating committee that's made up of state and federal agencies that periodically does funding fairs that are, advertised for a lot of people, including tribal organizations.
Yeah, just for the record, I was very much involved in the creation of the North Coast IRWIMP, now the North Coast Resource Partnership.
Yep.
And there we had a leadership mechanism set up, which actually involved tribal representatives on the leadership council, and mm-hmm. I'm going to be curious as to what's going to be happening with Proposition 4 monies as we go through your presentation. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there is a specific tribal water infrastructure allocation in Prop 4 for drinking water, but tribes are generally eligible for all of the different funding pots.
Thank you.
Yep. So this gives you an idea of how much funding we have. So from the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, the federal funds, we have over $800 million. And we refer to this as principal forgiveness because it's the state revolving fund loan. program, but the loan doesn't have to be repaid. So it's one of those great loans that all of us would love to have where the principal is forgiven. So it's essentially a grant. Our current year proposed loan commitments are about $370 million. Not all of those will be executed this year, but so that's right around our loan capacity of $300 million, sort of long-term loan capacity. And then keep in mind, we have a lot of loans outstanding, so folks are repaying us annually. They're generally 30-year loans. There's also funding specific for emerging contaminants like 123 TCP or PFAS, and that's about around $200 million that we have available.
Can I interject a question?
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Sorry, I can't be there in person. This is going to be a very ignorant question, but I want to make sure I have my understanding correct here. How does one, is it, I'm assuming it's the applicant that decides, or is it your office? How do you decide whether or not to go for a loan versus just a straight grant? Like, what's the process in that?
Yeah, good question. Thanks. And I'll touch on some of that. So we have eligibility criteria for the grant, for both the grants and the loans. So for the grants in general, the eligibility is around, the focus is on small disadvantaged communities. And then I'll touch on for both drinking water and clean water what some of those project eligibilities are. So mostly we focus on small communities. And then for the loan, the board just recently changed some of its scoring. So introduced a scoring process for drinking water. We've had it for clean water, but we're trying to emphasize more, even on the loan side, looking at affordability considerations more expressly. So, and when we do that, we use a relatively simple metric of looking at the rate, whether it's a sewer rate or water rate, compared to the median household income. Did that answer your question?
Yes, and it sounds like I was jumping the gun a little bit.
That's okay.
Probably going to talk about it later in your presentation, but thank you. Yes, that gives me a jump start.
Okay. So what I want to do is just give you a little idea of what we've had historically. Proposition 1 was passed in 2014 and Prop 68 in 2018. So most of those funds have already been committed, expended. We have very little left from those older general obligation bond funds. Prop 4, you can see, actually has a little more funding than we've had historically with the other propositions. And the amount we get from the legislature to expend out of that whole 280 is rolled out over each fiscal year, so we don't get it all at once. And then, as I mentioned, there's a tribal water infrastructure specific pot as well. So overall, about $300 million will be available from Prop 4 for drinking water projects.
And that's over what period of time going forward?
We'll probably get that funding out, most of it out in the next 3 to 5 years. You know, so we didn't get all the appropriation right up front. We got a little less than half of it. And that's to allow, you know, some projects that might be in a planning stage now. We don't want all the money to go out right away for just those ready to proceed projects, because some folks are in planning. So the rollout is kind of staged in that way.
But the state board has the authority to disburse these drinking water Prop 4 funds.
Not all of it. The legislature first appropriates it. So the way the bonds work, you know, the voters vote on it,
right?
So they give authority essentially to issue those bonds,
right?
Then the legislature has to appropriate the funds. They don't necessarily appropriate the whole amount in 1 year, and the reason for that is, you can imagine, the state, as soon as money goes out the door or is needed from a bond, then the state has to they issue these general obligation bonds, and then they have to pay interest on it. So we and all the other agencies coordinate with the resources agency on a rollout plan, sort of what do we anticipate we'll need for an appropriation over the years, because it also pays for our staff too. So we have a rollout plan to pay for our staffing in addition to when we anticipate we'll need the funding for projects. And one of the things we do is we look at what are the other funding sources that we have. So right now we're flush with federal funding. So we don't have as much of an immediate need for the state funding on the drinking water side or even the clean water side at the moment.
But is the federal funding now going to cease, or is it?
Yeah, so the bipartisan infrastructure law had 5 years of appropriation, and it was right. A huge amount of money. That ends, the last year is next year. So the next year is the fifth year. After that, there's a funding cliff from the federal government. And part of what's happened with the feds is even with our sort of our base state revolving fund allocation, they've been identifying earmarks. So we've been getting half of our base allocation the last several years. Now, that hasn't been noticeable because the bipartisan infrastructure law sort of masked that. But if the feds keep earmarking projects, we're going to be getting a lot less funding through the state revolving fund programs.
When the feds are earmarking, by that, do you mean federal legislators or federal agencies?
It's the members of Congress will make a, they're invited by those, appropriation committees
right.
to submit their wish list of projects. And then however they do it in the back room, they decide which projects to fund. Now, it sounds wonderful if you're one of those communities, but the downside is, in general, they don't provide enough funding to do the project. And then the other thing is, because the money doesn't come through our program, the money doesn't it reduces our loan capacity, which and also decreases the amount that the state can decide, like, what are the highest priorities, because it's basically the folks in a congressional office who hear a pitch from a community and they say, okay, I'll get you $1 million for such and such project.
So how successful have our federal legislators been?
They've been very successful.
Okay.
Yeah. So California's gotten more our total amount of SRF funding that, if you count the earmarks, is greater than what it would be otherwise. Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Yep. So as I mentioned, the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund has $130 million through 2045. That all depends on the proceeds from the auctions on greenhouse gas reduction credits. We have a little money from the cleanup and abatement account that we can use for drinking water needs. So when you all issue fines, those fines go to the cleanup and abatement account. We've also received appropriations from the general fund and kind of one-off appropriations from the greenhouse gas reduction fund. So we have about $150 million still that we haven't deployed. And previously, when we had a general fund surplus, we had about $450 million that we deployed, all for small community drinking water needs.
Thank you.
Sure. Now, on the clean water side, there's a broad suite of eligible projects, so typical sort of wastewater treatment facilities and improvements, sewer facilities, water recycling, reclamation, indirect potable reuse, regionalization consolidation, and septic to sewer, which is a big point of emphasis for our board and priority. And again, eligible recipients are pretty much the same: public agencies, tribes, 501c3 nonprofits. We don't work or have funding to support individual households unless it's a septic to sewer project. So again, the loans, they're based on a scoring system, so focus on projects that are addressing violations. Water resiliency projects like water recycling, and also we want to make sure there's a complete application. On the grants or principal forgiveness side, there's small disadvantaged communities, as I said, are a big focus. The water recycling grants are primarily through Prop 4. So I'll touch on that in a minute. The board doesn't use any of the federal funds for grants for water recycling. We do have some principal forgiveness for stormwater projects. There's a little bit of funding that goes to the Bay Delta Estuary, and priority is also public health projects like the septic to sewer. So the main kind of criteria are what kind of water quality improvements do we expect to see, any broader benefits, where we do prioritize based on whether the regional board has issued any sort of violation. So if a system is out of compliance and they're looking to address that compliance issue through a project, then that project for small communities especially will get prioritized. And we also want to make sure that when we're funding a project, they're ready to go, that it's beyond the conceptual phase. So we do have funding for planning. Our preference is that folks get far along in planning before they come to us for construction funding.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask our executive officer, so how do we, as the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, how do we get our wishes known to the state board?
Yeah, I'll ask Claudia to answer that question.
Good afternoon. So in the past, we have written memos to the Division of Financial Assistance with a list of our priorities to communicate what the regional board feels are a priority for our region in terms of funding. So my understanding is that DFA takes that into consideration when they're going to allocate funding or enter into a funding agreement with an entity that has submitted an application for either a planning grant or construction grant or loan.
So if I might follow up, I can't remember any question, I mean, any sort of decisions coming to us as board members on this matter. This is totally staff-driven?
It is at the staff level. Under Charles's division, staff under his division prioritize the projects and then submit. I think the last time we submitted maybe our top 15 or dozen projects that we thought should be prioritized for our region, and it was sent under Matt St. John's signature at the time. So I've asked Charles to develop a similar list and provide that moving forward. And to update our list. But we do have that, and we do have close coordination with DFA, but Charles can maybe provide more detailed information.
Well, I must say, Mr. Chair, I'm interested in how we could get this information to us just so that we're aware
of course
what these priorities are.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I'm very interested in this whole question of funding and how the mechanisms work, having been very much involved with the North Coast Resource Partnership and distribution of previous proposition monies.
So as an example, if a municipality has some equipment breakdowns and is low on funds, or they need to do an upgrade during an inspection, they communicate to our staff that they have certain needs, and then that goes on potentially on a list?
That's correct. So, I mean, that's a simplified version of it. I don't think it's that simple, but they identify needs, and if they need assistance from us, our staff helps them through the DFA process and connects them with DFA. Mm-hmm. And at times, we have actually prepared applications on their behalf, and then they sign off, and then we start the kickoff meeting with DFA staff, connect the two entities, DFA to the POTW, the wastewater treatment plant facility, and then we let them go. Or if they need us to continue to support them, a regional board staff supports and is sort of a liaison or a coordinator with DFA as well. And as you know, a lot of our facilities in this region lack the capacity to actually write proposals. So we're also working with the North Coast Resource Partnership to develop an agreement to help with that process as well, to help them actually put together the application packages for DFA.
But entities like the City of Santa Rosa, who operates a sub-regional plant, and Sonoma Water, who also operates plants, they're well-staffed and well-able. And so is there a process that they participate in annually where they let their needs are conveyed to us and to the financial assistance people?
They have sufficient resources, and they actually have, I believe, like grant writers on staff.
Yep.
So they don't go through us. They don't ask for our help. They have for the Russian River TMDL action plan implementation process. We have coordinated a different process for that, where we have tapped into the technical assistance program at DFA through the RCAC contract that they have. And that is a technical assistance program that helps the communities in the Lower Russian River seek funding.
And one last question at the moment. US EPA Region 9 Water Division, do their staff get involved in this process in any way, the feds?
They do. They also have funding available, and I think Tina Lowe can expand a little bit. There have been some assistance and funding provided through EPA grants to Sonoma Water for the Russian River wastewater project in terms of septic to sewer for the OTS that need to be upgraded or connected to a nearby collection system. There has been some feasibility funding made available for that.
Good. Thank you.
Through US EPA. I'm looking to...
I have a couple quick questions before we move on. So and I don't know if this could be a question for staff or whoever's most appropriate to answer this question. Is the regional staff, are they always involved in an application or like projects are selected on priority always, or that just goes into the factor? Like, what if there's a project that comes up that they did it independently of the regional board and it's a good project? I mean, do those projects get funded, or does it always have to have a priority, and does it always have to have staff like kind of mediating almost?
It does not have to always have. It is not based on the priorities. If the City of Santa Rosa, for example, wants to submit an application on their own with our regional board staff support, they can. And DFA functions on a first-come, first-served basis, and they have their own criteria that they use to prioritize, which is in line with our criteria as well. So they can proceed forward without regional board support.
Thank you.
Maybe to clarify, I think part of your interest is when might it be helpful to weigh in. So every year we prepare an intended use plan for both the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. So in general, that intended use plan comes out in April or May. And part of that includes the criteria that, you know, staff are proposing to the board. The other aspect of that will include a list, and there are a couple lists. One is what we call the fundable list. So based on the criteria staff are proposing, which projects of which we are aware that are in the hopper look like they would be fundable based on those proposed criteria. And then we have a comprehensive list. So, you know, kind of everyone that's applied for funding. And then all sorts of folks have an opportunity to weigh in. Now, many of the larger entities are more active, like in CASA or water reuse, you know, and so those associations will kind of opine on what staff are proposing. We also, the other thing that we're able to do on an ongoing basis, because we have a continuous application process, is as the board has delegated authority to me to add projects to the fundable list. So, you know, if a project isn't ready around the time that we put out our intended use plan, but the planning and application gets far enough along later, then we're able to add those qualifying projects to the fundable list. So essentially, a project has to be on this fundable list to be considered for funding. So then we kind of run them through our process from there.
I see. Thank you.
Sure. All right.
And Board Member McKenzie, I just wanted to note that next time we, you know, come up with a formal list of priority projects to send to DFA, we could certainly provide that to board members and be available for any questions board members might have about those projects.
I am particularly interested in this whole process of funding, as you've known ever since I've joined the board and have been involved in my past careers and been a grant officer and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway.
Yeah,
so I'm a very curious sort of person.
Yeah, no, that's why I'm here. I'm glad you're asking questions. And like Claudia mentioned, you know, although we may get lists from different regional boards of priorities, if a project is qualifying and fundable, we're not like taking things like in a specific order. We have enough staff that we're working on many project applications at the same time. So it's basically our board sets the funding criteria, the eligibility criteria, and we run with that.
Thank you.
Yep. So on the clean water side, for kind of grant and principal forgiveness, there's a little over $300 million this year. We have, as I mentioned, an annual loan capacity of $600 million. I put this note here about the program is leveraged. So this is very unique. We just issued revenue bonds, which means because we're like a bank and we get revenue from the repayment of the loans, we can actually issue bonds that gives us more cash flow in the near term. So we just issued a $600 million revenue bond. So we leverage that those loans that we have within our portfolio. So it helps us expand our loan capacity beyond what it otherwise might be. So some of our state funding sources, just to give you a bit of an idea for water recycling and wastewater, there, when we had the state general fund surplus, we got a lot of money. We deployed those resources for small community wastewater, a lot of septic to sewer projects. Currently, from our general fund and greenhouse gas reduction fund, the amounts we have are more modest, but we're still deploying those resources. And then this gives you a little glimpse on Prop 1 and Prop 68, what historically we've had for wastewater and water recycling. You can see there's a pretty good chunk of money for water recycling. That was about half and half went to grants versus loans, so we still get those loan portions coming back to us. Prop 68 wasn't quite as generous. And then on the wastewater side for Prop 1, we got a pretty decent amount of funding there, but it's pretty much all expended. Then for Prop 4, this graph shows how much funding we will have. It actually hasn't all been appropriated yet, but about $280 million for small community wastewater and about $360 million for water recycling projects. And in general, for water recycling projects, most of those are pretty big projects, so it's larger communities that come to us. And so in general, they'll get some grant, and then they'll usually finance the rest with, or a large portion with, state revolving fund loan from us.
And how broad a scope does water recycling include, just in terms of the types of projects?
Yeah, it can include, you know, the advanced treatment that's necessary, like if there's going to be an indirect potable reuse, so it can include that. It can include, you know, the pipeline that you need to run to, like if it's going to a park or irrigated agriculture, a golf course, or wherever. So it can include any of the infrastructure that's needed for that project purpose.
Are you involved in any desalinization projects or treatment or control of the brine?
Yeah. So we actually, I just went to a ribbon cutting in Antioch. We're mentioning Highway 12, where your other board member is traveling right now. So Antioch has a desal project that we helped fund. So for drinking water, right? Because periodically their intake, it's, you know, salty water from the Delta. And so they have that capacity now to use reverse osmosis to reduce the salinity levels there. So, yep.
Are you involved with Fort Bragg?
Yeah, we do. I know we have a groundbreaking or ribbon cutting we're going to in Fort Bragg in a couple of weeks here. So, yes. Yeah.
That's what Claudia and I were just whispering about, was Fort Bragg. And Charles and I and Matt Herman of your staff were up in Fort Bragg a couple weeks ago previewing their desalination buoy pilot project that's wasn't out in the ocean yet when we saw it. It was sitting on land, but we got to check it out. It's a really cool project.
Yeah, and I think it was it Fort Bragg that, I'm trying to remember if it was Fort Bragg that we helped out one of your communities during the drought. Yeah, it was with a temporary system. Yeah.
Right. It was a temporary system, and Charles was involved too, and DFA worked directly with us to try to help them with that drought period that they had.
Right. Okay, let's see. So also stormwater, so the eligibilities are pretty broad in general. One of the conditions, especially for the Prop 4 funding, is that the community has to have a stormwater resource plan in order to qualify. So we have several funding sources. We have some federal funding. It's actually both stormwater and for sewer system overflow, but we're using the funding for stormwater projects. The Clean Water SRF, we have about $20 million in principal forgiveness in total available. So we're capping those projects at $5 million. And then Proposition 4, we're now working on the guidelines. But Prop 4 just has a little over $100 million that will be available for projects, which isn't a huge amount, and it's focused on urban, multi-beneficial use stormwater projects. And this kind of goes over what I just talked about. And again, with Prop 4, we'll probably have the funding guidelines. We hope to have that adopted by our board in the summertime, and we'll have workshops and that sort of thing prior to that. Proposition 1 had $200 million, which has been fully committed to projects. The other thing I want to touch on is our technical assistance program, which is very robust. So we have technical assistance quite a bit for on the drinking water side. We do have technical assistance on the wastewater side, but our funding sources aren't quite as robust there, so it's more limited. But it's the technical assistance is pretty broad, so it can be as simple as helping out with a funding application to full project planning specs and design. So we have some technical assistance, and the way we do this is we have a funding agreement with a technical assistance provider. When we get a request for technical assistance, we'll farm that out to an appropriate technical assistance provider. They prepare a work plan. We review and approve it. You know, we'll work with, like, you know, the regional board or Division of Drinking Water, and then that TA provider will work with that community. In some cases, if it's like a full planning design project, including environmental, we can deploy, like, you know, $600,000 up to, you know, $1 million. I've seen those kind of range for technical assistance, especially on the drinking water side. The benefit there is that the community doesn't have to go through like a separate planning application process. You know, this kind of short circuits a lot of that. So it's been pretty successful. On the drinking water side, we're actually able to provide grants directly to private entities, which has been super helpful for those full planning projects. But we do have a cadre of nonprofit organizations that we work with as well. So the priorities for drinking water is given to systems that are failing, you know, so they're out of compliance, or in some cases, like with hexavalent chromium, they may not be out of compliance now, but will be once those compliance dates occur, so they're eligible for funding. Systems that are at risk of failing, so those are also prioritized, and we do prioritize consolidation projects. So the board wants to see fewer small water systems. On the wastewater side, the big emphasis is on septic to sewer projects, and regionalization of small wastewater systems where that is feasible. Most of the projects we're seeing are the septic to sewer projects. So the technical assistance is very helpful in helping those communities complete our application, preparing all the documents needed. And again, we'll do things like we can provide legal assistance, do rate studies, which is really important. That was misspelling there. It should say capacity building. Some of our technical assistance providers also have bridge loans. So for small communities that are in construction that can't wait for reimbursement from us, they can get a low interest rate bridge loan. And so we accept these requests on a continuous basis. So, can come from a regional board. You know, we get these requests coming from our Division of Drinking Water colleagues, from the TA provider, from the water system. We accept it in all sorts of forms. It's a pretty simple form to fill out. And then, we end up, if needed, contacting the requester to get more information. And as I said, then our staff will identify the appropriate technical assistance provider. Did you have a question?
I was just wondering through the executive officer. So do we actually make requests for technical assistance as the regional board?
Yes, we actually make requests on behalf of the entity.
Oh, okay.
So they are on board, but we fill out the form and we connect them with DFA and start the kickoff meeting.
So there's a process, an annual process, where we do outreach to all of our clients?
On an as-needed basis. Okay. It's a continuous basis.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, so one of the things, I think with your region, obviously they know about our technical assistance program. So certainly to the extent that your staff know when they're going out and doing an inspection, they can make folks aware of that technical assistance. And so I will say on the wastewater side, it's more limited right now. We're pretty much at capacity. We should be getting some more resources available soon through Proposition 4. Prop 4 allows for us to use some of those funds for technical assistance. So we will make maximum use of those funds.
I just want to say, Mr. Chair, that this has been a particularly helpful presentation, getting an understanding of what I've often wondered about, and now I'm feeling a lot better educated. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Keep on.
Yeah. I also just want to add, Jake, to your question about kind of proactive outreach to facilities. We do have a position in our office whose job is more focused on kind of proactive outreach and understanding needs of facilities. You might remember Mike Reese gave a presentation to the board about our wastewater needs assessment efforts. We lost Mike to Region 6. He's now working in that region. So we're working on filling that position. And so we expect to be a little bit more back in the realm of also doing some proactive outreach in addition to the kind of as needed things we learn about through inspections. But that's been a slightly paused because of that change in staffing.
So is the, just a separate thing. Is the State Board have major control over the distribution of Prop 4 monies? In the past, there were different agencies that were distributing various proposition monies, but I'm getting the sense from you that we have control over most of the Prop 4 monies? No?
We have about $1.2 billion of the $10
billion. Okay.
Yeah, there are I think there are between 80 and 100 different programs that are receiving funding. Okay. Through Prop 4, so it's a broad range. You know, the Department of Food and Ag's involved, pretty much every conservancy, Department of Water Resources.
Right.
So, yeah, so there are a lot of different folks administering different pieces of Prop 1. So, yeah, I mean, we have 12% or so of it, which is a good chunk. And, you know, so the programs that we have, drinking water, wastewater, water recycling, there's stormwater. The tribal water is part of the drinking water, and then there's some U.S.-Mexico border funding as well to deal with the Tijuana and New Rivers.
The decisions have now been made within state government as to how Proposition 4 monies are going to be distributed.
Yeah, the voters decided that when they passed Prop 4. So Prop 4 had those allocations baked in. In some cases, with all the programs we're running, the State Water Board was identified as the administering entity. So the thing we haven't done, so one of our challenges, and this is a little in the weeds, is that in general we've had exemptions from the Administrative Procedures Act and rulemaking requirements. That was not included in Prop 4. So we actually have to go through a rulemaking this time. Now, it's an emergency rulemaking, which has some streamlining benefits. But we were actually ready. We had already our board had adopted our intended use plans.
Okay.
So had we had an exemption, we would have been ready to deploy Prop 4 right away. But now we have to go through a rulemaking process. So the money's not – so all of the rules about the distribution of the money and eligibility criteria have not been established yet.
Okay.
Just in the broad framework of what's in the statute.
Thanks.
Yep.
And I just wanted to make my statement a little bit more complete about our staff's proactive outreach efforts. I mentioned our position that's focused on disadvantaged community needs assessment. What I didn't mention was Tina Lowe's role as an engineer who's focused on recycled water. And so Tina, who you met earlier in the year when she provided the board a presentation about recycled water, she's also involved in proactive outreach to identify opportunities to expand water recycling and help help those facilities connect with financial assistance resources.
And just to add to that, in the absence of Mike Reese, Charles and I have taken over some of that work as well. So,
all right. So this gives you a little bit of an idea of, you know, the amount of technical assistance funding that's available. You know, Prop 4, again, that's a relatively modest amount compared to how much we have from our other funding sources, especially for drinking water. So actually, I think at this point, this isn't totally complete picture, but we have around $300 million we've been able to put towards technical assistance for drinking water systems. And a lot of that is to do full planning and design for needed projects. And again, the eligibility is primarily with small disadvantaged communities on the wastewater side. Again, we're supporting the septic to sewer conversion projects as a focus. I also wanted to mention, you know, our cleanup fund, which has been a workhorse for decades now. And we also have our site cleanup sub-account program. So the cleanup fund is for underground storage tanks, petroleum underground storage tanks. This gives you sort of an overview of the active claims in your area by county. And then our site cleanup subaccount program, we have some active grants as well. So a lot of the site cleanup subaccount, that's primarily for those responsible parties that don't have the financial ability to do a cleanup. So a lot of dry cleaner sites, that's primarily the focus. And our board has recently updated its scoring method. We have a scoring methodology for the site cleanup subaccount program. Focuses primarily on disadvantaged communities, environmental justice communities, as well as looking at risk pathways. So our staff working with the regional board staff, the different regions, those site cleanup project managers will evaluate the data. We have a risk scoring matrix, and then we put that on a comprehensive list, and we see what we can fund, which isn't a lot, honestly. There's over 400 projects we have, applications right now, and we get about $40 million a year. And these projects typically, from assessment to cleanup, can run $5 to $10 million.
May I ask?
Yeah.
Does any of this cleanup overlap with cannabis sites?
No. No, right now the way our board has prioritized, there's so many of those dry cleaning sites that have current impacts that are, a lot of times they're near sensitive receptors. So that's the other thing we look at, is if there's potential vapor intrusion risk to nearby residences or schools or daycares, that sort of thing. So that's where the focus is with those funds. And again, it's a very small pot of money relative to the overall need. So this gives you sort of a brief look at, for your region. There have been a number of projects that have been funded. We also have contract funds that are available, too, so we can provide grants. And in general, the process, just so you all know, with the grants, is that there's essentially a joint team that includes the regional board staff or whoever the regulatory overseer is. Sometimes it's DTSC, our state board, DFA staff, and then the consultant as well as the responsible party. So it's a collaborative effort to identify what needs to be done at a site. But ultimately, the funding decision resides with Division of Financial Assistance. I'll pause here because I know I've used a lot of time, and I can go through some of these projects that are in your area, or happy to entertain further questions or any discussion you'd like to have. So I'm here at your pleasure. So however,
I kind of have a follow-up on Hector's last question. I'm just curious why nothing, is it contemplated to eventually include cannabis cleanup sites? Because that is kind of a clean drinking water issue and, sanitation, all that. Or can you expound upon the cannabis site, topic?
I'm not aware of any specific funding sources for cannabis cleanup. Now, as a general matter, that site cleanup subaccount funding or our cleanup and abatement account could potentially be used for those purposes. So, and as I said, for the site cleanup program, the focus has been on soil and groundwater contamination impacts, primarily from those dry cleaner sites. Our board will be, in the next months or so, looking at how to use the funds we have available from the cleanup and abatement account. So we just recently were able to reconcile the cleanup and abatement account, so we have a good idea of how much funding is available. So we still have to go to our board with a staff recommendation. So stay tuned for that. And certainly, Valerie and the other executive officers at the regions and the AEOs are going to be informed as we go along and develop our staff recommendation.
And then regarding grants for...
Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. Regarding grants for cannabis site cleanup, I was aware in the past of a CDFW grant program for cannabis site cleanup that I believe was funded by the Cannabis Tax Fund. I'm not sure the status of that, but just kind of reflecting that when the state has resources for a certain subject area like cleanup of cannabis sites, they may make the choice to route those funds through a different agency rather than routing them through the water board. So that I'm like I said, I'm not sure the status of that program, but it may still be going on just through a different agency than us. Not aware. Yeah. I have heard, you know, anecdotally of cannabis sites in our region talking about applying for such grants. So our cannabis program staff would be more aware of that, and I can certainly follow up with them and get more of a lay of the land of what funding might be out there for cannabis site cleanup. And I'll mark that down on my list and make sure to provide board members any follow up on that I have.
That would be fantastic.
Please do. Thank you, Valerie.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah. So let's see if we can. There we go. So I'll go through a couple of these projects. I will not be able to answer any detailed questions about them, but if you have any, I will sure get back to you. So one is the Willow Creek wastewater project. So again, this is like a septic to sewer project. You guys are probably more aware of this than I am, I'm sure. So I don't need to tell you what the water quality issues are. But there's been funding provided, you know, the Prop 1 funding. And so again, part of it is to get a centralized wastewater system in, including the treatment. So it looks like the status is good from what my staff are reporting. I don't know if your staff are reporting hopefully the same thing, that construction, the collection system is just about finished. There are still, you know, a few things that need to be done, but they expect completion in about a year or so.
And I can add that board members might remember, Jake, I'm not sure if you were on the board, but I know Hector would have been. That it, in the last few years, this board approved waste discharge requirements for this new system in Willow Creek that's being constructed. It didn't get much fanfare because it was an uncontested item, but staff were, you know, really, really thrilled to bring forward that development in this community. So.
And just to add, as I recall, this was one of the projects that our regional board staff assisted the community in getting the funding and connecting with EFA as well.
Yeah.
I have another quick question since we're talking about projects. I promise it's not details about a specific one, but rather I would imagine or I would assume that there are for the loan projects, are there like deadlines that things have to be done? Like you have to have 60% construction by this date and all these things. So you have to go out and like actually inspect construction, or are those requirements not in existence? And if they are, is it just for loans? Is it also for grant applications? I mean, can you kind of expound upon that?
Yeah, sure. So as folks are applying for funding, you know, we do generally expect the planning and design to be fairly far along, especially on the wastewater side, before we'll commit funding to it. So that's part of what our team does. They look at the plans and specs, whether it's, you know, 60% design or more, as well as looking at, you know, have they gone through CEQA and if NEPA applies as well, you know, because there are these hangups that can occur, like if they haven't properly looked at cultural resources or biological resources, done those investigations so that they can mitigate any potential impacts from the project. Whether it's grant or loan, they have to do that. the loan side, it's just trickier on the financing, right? So that's when we actually do a deeper dive on their financials, look at what community's existing debt might be, look at their ability to repay any loan that we might provide, because we have a certain debt service coverage. We want to make sure their revenues are more than sufficient to make payments on any loan we provide. Now, during construction, yeah, certainly our team goes out periodically to do inspections. The project manager does to make sure it's being built per the scope.
What happens if they're significantly behind schedule, or there's some discrepancy between what was originally funded under the grant application versus what's going on in reality? Mm-hmm. During construction, has there ever been a case where there's something is gone awry?
I think things generally go awry in some way, but whether it's, you know, accounted for, because there, you know, there is the ability to do change orders because things come up, you know, when you actually start digging. Now, if there, the thing is, the where we try to really stay on top of things is making sure that the funding recipient stays within the scope of the project that's covered by the CEQA document. So, for example, like if they decided all of a sudden that the alignment is going needs to change, or that a property they're going to purchase is not available, that might require like a relook at that CEQA document. So, yeah, and I think when I go through a couple of these examples, yeah, we generally see delays. Like I think folks end up being pretty optimistic when they're doing their scheduling. You know, they provide the optimal schedule versus the realistic. So, you know, a lot of the work my staff...
Yeah, it's just any construction project. Yeah, right. Any construction project, you're going to just have things come up. Yeah, I get it. I was just curious. Thank you.
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, so like specifically for Willow Creek, some of the things that came up were long lead times for equipment. And again, you know, I know especially like during the pandemic when there were shortages of equipment and supplies, you know, folks would be, you know, they have to put in their orders for the equipment well in advance of when they would need it. You know, you all and, you know, of course, in the Lahontan region, they have this as well around Lake Tahoe. Weather issues can impede construction. And of course, there are also a lot of times there are timing issues on when they can do the construction if there's a species of concern. So there's a related project for related to this one that is tied to it, which is related to the decommissioning and lateral installation. So the report there is that they'll start doing those connections after the treatment plant is fully operational. And then, let's see, we have Arcata. So that's a pretty good chunk of money for principal forgiveness. So you all are the ones that identify these violations on the water quality issues. So the goal is, of course, to bring the treatment plant into compliance by, you know, replacing, rehabilitating, or adding treatment elements. So it's nearly complete, and I guess we're hoping to get this done actually this year, this month, as long as weather permits. So, and I'm sure you all know all the details of this project. I would guess it was a subject of much discussion in front of your board. So then some other projects in the area, the Lolita, is that how you say it? Lolita, okay. Is we have an executed agreement. So again, it's to address compliance issues. As I said, those are our priorities with funding. McKinleyville has a lead service line inventory project. So that's to help them meet their division drinking water requirements. Then we're providing technical assistance for 6 acres and South Cloverdale to, you know, again, it's a sewer consolidation project. And also it looks like with South Cloverdale, there's a compliance order from the division of drinking water. So looking at, you know, the consolidation and annexation of those communities. So the status there is, looks like we're pretty far along, plans and specs, draft environmental package, and let's see. So one of the challenges we run into with consolidations especially is who's going to apply for the funding. So as you're aware, a lot of times the municipality or special district, they can't spend their funds on something other than the service they're providing, right? So that becomes a challenge with consolidation. So even when we're fully providing the funding, dedicating that staff time can be challenging, especially for smaller municipalities. So that's one of the challenges we're running into here is who's going to apply for the funding. So we need somebody, and who's going to oversee the project. Now, we can support the city as part of the construction agreement and pay for staff, pay their staff costs. That's not a problem. But, you know, when certain municipalities are constrained with staff, they have a small staff, they may be unwilling to take on these kinds of projects. So the technical assistance work is expected to be done mid next year. So there are a couple other projects here with 6 acres. There's some work providing them bottled water. There's an operation and maintenance agreement on the drinking water side. And then lastly, I wanted to just hear a bunch of web links that we have and for our various programs and contact information as well. So that was all I have. Happy to answer any other questions.
Joe, thank you so much for your presentation. It was,
of course,
relatively eye-opening for me. And just to hear the detail of the funding process and everything you're involved with. And it's a great benefit to have you helping our region out. Jake, do you have any questions?
No question. Just repeat what I said earlier, that this has been extremely helpful and very complete, and also has enabled me to ask questions of staff, and look forward to being kept up to date, as the executive officer promised us. So it's good, Mr. Chair.
I think I would like to highlight the assistance to tribal communities,
mm-hmm.
and ask that sometimes they're reluctant to reach out and ask that the staff or a mechanism to reach out to them be created or encouraged.
Yeah, and I do want to point out one of the big challenges we've seen in engaging with tribal communities is any federally recognized tribe is a sovereign entity, right? And so the challenge is when we provide state funding, we request a limited waiver of that sovereign immunity, which basically allows us to, if anything goes sideways, we have a venue where we can resolve that dispute or disagreement. So that's basically what it's for. But understandably, a lot of tribes are reluctant to sign off on that. So it's very, again, it's limited. It allows us to go look at the project, or if there's any challenge that needs to be resolved, which we rarely, if ever, happen, where you'd have to go to court, there are provisions to do that. Now, with some tribes, we've been able to work through those issues. With others, you know, we've talked about it, and there's just the kind of a line we can't cross, right? Because we can't just provide funds to folks without having any accountability mechanism in place.
If there's an unrecognized tribe or group or community, is there do you reach out to them, or are they helped out in any way?
Yeah, so state recognized tribes are, you know, the ones that aren't federally recognized would still qualify for funding, you know. And in those cases, you know, the situation's different. They're not recognized as a separate sovereign entity, so we don't have that same potential issue. Now, we still need an entity to deal with, right, which can be challenging in a number of different situations. So, but certainly they're eligible for funding.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. And I did, you know, I want to compliment your staff. It's great that the, you know, your executive management team has encouraged your staff to work with our staff, engaging directly. It's great. Not every region does that to the same degree. So that's super helpful.
We have a great team.
Yeah, I know you do. Yeah. So we love having those collaborative relationships because obviously you folks are boots on the ground, have insights that our folks don't necessarily have. So thank you for the invitation to come talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Yep.
And in the spirit of our collaborative relationship, I want to invite Charles Reed up to also provide some closing remarks, the regional perspective on our work with DFA.
Thanks. All this conversation has teed up my remarks really well, I must say. And I want to first thank you for coming here, Joe, and presenting this in person. And I want to thank you and DFA staff for the support you've given us over the years. It's been really important to us and to the disadvantaged communities, especially in our region, to get that sort of support to improve their infrastructure. And this has especially been true since Prop 1 in the mid-2014-15 time, when there was a lot of money available, and there was a lot of a big push to get that money allocated out. So our collaboration with DFA really helped that process, I think, quite a lot. And I think over time, we began to feel like it was more of a partnership than it had been in the past. Which is, I think, what is intended to be. And it really worked out well for us and our dischargers to have that sort of collaboration and partnership. DFA was able to explain the rather opaque SRF process and teach us, and it's an ongoing learning experience. I know I've learned a lot today that I wasn't aware of. But they've, I think most importantly, from my perspective, is we feel like we have a place at the table that we didn't previously when it comes to having some input on the projects to get funded. That's been very important for us. And I think it's helped bring those sorts of projects to the finish line, ultimately, to have some water board input early on. So certainly there's been some really big wins for our region. Joe talked about Willow Creek a little bit, and that's one of them. I think we expected that project to be completed a little quicker than it has been. But another project that has been completed that was equally important to us was a grant of over $16 million that the community of Lewiston and Trinity County received back in the pandemic era that allowed them to replace, this was a severely disadvantaged community, allowed them to replace a essentially failing wastewater system almost completely and to consolidate three separate wastewater treatment systems into one. So all of that Lewiston area, most of that that's not on septic systems, is connected to this sewer plant now. And the Willow Creek project, the Lewiston projects, which were very big, expensive projects for our region, could definitely not have been done without the substantial input that we got from public funding. Without those grants available, they would not have happened. There are still some challenges in funding. I don't know that you have seen this yet, but when Joe provided us with his presentation, he also gave us a number of Excel spreadsheets that identify all the active construction projects, the active planning projects, and some of the technical assistance projects that are being funding. And these are worth millions of dollars. So there's a lot of work still to do. And closer to home, we actually have some projects in the West County where they're investigating regional consolidation for wastewater and expanding water recycling. So we're hopeful that those sorts of projects can be continued to be funded as they move towards construction, ultimately, hopefully. One thing, since I'm here and they gave me the microphone, I wanted to give some special thanks. We refer to Joe and his team, Joe and the DFA staff, but there are actual people who have helped us specifically over the last few years. And I kind of spent some time and wrote the names down, and I wanted to mention and give them special thanks. I may be forgetting some people, but and if I do, I'm sorry. But I wanted to run through some names who have been really helpful to us. Jennifer Tony, Ahmad Kashkoli, May Bunty, Angie Norda, I'm sorry, James Garcia, Matt Chambers, Gabriel Berzamina, Gerlin Bhatia Takar, Dot Tran, Bridget Chase, Maureen Siddiqui, Otto Tang, Chris Stevens, Winolin and Francine Fua from the past, and I think especially the former deputy director, Jim Mon, who was instrumental in ensuring that the funding for Lewiston and Willow Creek was able to be obtained. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't also, point to some of the regional board staff who have been really critical in this. Recently retired Roy O'Connor, I think maybe some of you are familiar with, made a career essentially out of helping disadvantaged communities obtain funding for the projects that were needed. And also Claudia Villacorta, who is kind of our DFA insider, who always seems to know the right levers to push and buttons to push to get DFA staff to listen to us and take our input. So I thought it was important to say that because the funding programs at the DFA and our help at the region board has always been a really a program that's really close to my heart because I've always wanted to help these small communities comply with our permits. So since I'm going to be retiring in a few months, this is going to be the last time I have an opportunity to thank all those people, so I wanted to do that. And closing, I'd like to, on behalf of staff, also express how proud we are of our coordination and with DFA to get these funds to these disadvantaged communities. It's been very rewarding for all of us, and I can commit to doing this in the future, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Charles. And I want to recognize Tina as well for her contributions. And thank you for your presentation. And I wasn't aware you were retiring, so congratulations.
Thanks.
What month?
Charles likes to fly under the radar.
End of February.
Yeah, congratulations. Fantastic. Okay.
We have we had three people sign up to comment on Zoom, and I believe at least one of them is on there. I'm not sure who else, but Deidre can cue those folks up.
Thank you.
Yes, we have one person online to comment. Katie, can you unmute and state your name to make sure we can hear you?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Honorable Board Chair and Board Members. My name is Katie Marcelon. I work for the City of Eureka. I'm grateful to hear the dynamic conversation today and the engagement on this important agenda item. I've been fortunate to work with your staff, and they encouraged our participation here today. So again, compliments and thank you to your staff. As noted during the conversation, there are various layers of funding and how those funds are accessed or distributed. Eureka is providing comment today to bring attention to the challenges that we specifically face as a large disadvantaged community that Eureka does not currently qualify under the designation of a small disadvantaged community. So just to give a little context, I work with the Eureka Engineering Department, and our engineering department is responsible for planning and implementation of capital projects. Those include some short-term and also long-term infrastructure projects, and then aligning the funding towards those projects. Our engineering department works closely with Public Works for all of the ongoing maintenance and improvements to our public work infrastructure. And related to this matter, those would include our water treatment facility, water distribution systems, our stormwater systems, our sanitary sewer collections, and our wastewater treatment facility. So just a high level of how we are trying to plan for and manage infrastructure and the funding related to those. Eureka is located in Humboldt County and adjacent to Humboldt Bay, and we are a small city. In many cases, the infrastructure we manage serves not only our incorporated areas, but also our unincorporated areas. For example, the Elk River Wastewater Treatment Facility provides treatment for those properties within the city of Eureka and our collection system, as well as the surrounding unincorporated areas that are served by the collections within Humboldt Community Services District. The city is forecasting a number of large infrastructure projects to stay in compliance with regulatory measures, and those large-scale projects bring a large magnitude of cost. So the reason, again, for our public comment today is to highlight that Eureka does not currently meet the definition as a small disadvantaged community. As I understand it, the current definition would be a population less than 20,000 and a median household income of less than 80% of the statewide median household income. Currently, we're not in that bracket, and this unfairly impacts us and other rural cities. Eureka has roughly a population of 27,000, and we are considered disadvantaged to severely disadvantaged, depending on different pockets within our community. However, because our population exceeds that $20,000 person population, the city is currently ineligible for many of the funding sources that have been discussed today. In 2016, the city's wastewater discharge classification changed from an ocean discharge to a bay discharge. And since then, we have been working closely with your staff to meet the requirements of our waste discharge order. Unfortunately, the costs associated with several potential compliance alternatives are in some cases alarmingly high. And so the city, while we've already raised rates, we don't see a mechanism to continue to raise those rates to support the infrastructure and improvements that would be needed for our Elk River Wastewater Treatment Facility. We don't know how to carry these next steps or phases and how to face these financial burdens. We don't believe it's fair to pass that on to our ratepayers or our residents. And so we have been working closely with your staff in terms of balancing those different functions in our role. But we do feel that strongly reevaluating that threshold for the 20,000 person population would be another way to approach supporting communities like ours. To give you a little bit of context around Humboldt County, there are four large service providers: the City of Fortuna, McKinleyville, Arcata, and Eureka. Today you heard about Arcata's projects and some projects in McKinleyville. All three of those entities, only Eureka, right? There's three others that fit with under the 20,000 person, but only Eureka is ineligible to access the grants and principal forgiveness funding that is available through the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. So it's very difficult for our local, whether they're residents or property owners or business owners or even our elected officials, they don't understand how Arcata can qualify for different types of grants or loans, but Eureka, we're right next door and we cannot qualify for those. So we would encourage you again through this agenda item and your thoughtful attention to this matter and this robust conversation that you've had today to take it a step farther and reevaluate maybe this definition of small disadvantaged community and think about how rural communities that are just on that threshold could be better positioned to successfully meet their compliance targets. Thank you.
Katie, thank you for your comment. Any response, Joe?
Yeah, sure. I would encourage Katie and other communities that are in a similar situation to engage when we bring items before our board on our Clean Water State Revolving Fund intended use plan. And we recently updated the policy as well. So those thresholds, a number of them have been initially part of statute, like in Proposition 1. I'd have to go back and look if we've got that definition as part of the SRF in terms of defining small. So actually, on the drinking water side, small community is defined as 10,000 or less, and on the wastewater side, it's 20,000 or less. So the challenge that we always run into is, it's to the extent that we have more generous eligibility criteria for grant, all we've done is increase competition for the grant funds. We don't necessarily increase the amount of grant money available. So it's more folks, more projects going for the same amount of grant funds. And currently, the demand exceeds supply already. So, but again, it's kind of our board's policy decision on how it establishes priorities for grant or principal forgiveness. So they have some latitude in doing that. So, for example, one of the things they did last year, this past summer actually, was raise some of the caps that we had on grant or principal forgiveness for those small disadvantaged communities because we were running into some pretty significant septic to sewer projects, and there's also a pretty large wastewater treatment project as well that for a small community, less than 20,000, was going to be over $100 million. So our board has, adapted criteria based on its understanding of what some of the project priorities are. But again, that doesn't make more money available overall. The pot is still the same. You just have more folks coming to the table, but the same amount of food, essentially. So, I think as your staff is engaging on the wastewater needs assessment, which will help define not just for Eureka, but for other small communities within your area, what some of the overall needs are for capital improvements for sewer and wastewater infrastructure and treatment. And I think that will be telling. I mean, if it's anything like we've seen on the drinking water side, where there are billions of dollars of need for small drinking water systems, and we're able to fund a fraction of that. So that's the kind of current reality. Now, Eureka could qualify for, a loan, which, again, it's still a challenge for a smaller community to be able to repay a loan, but it's better financing than they could get on the open market. It's much lower interest rate, costs are spread out over a 30-year time period. So we're able to help with that as well.
Well, I hope that helps, Katie. Any questions? Thank you very much, Joe. Really appreciate your presentation and thoughtful comments. So, are there any items, any announcements, Madam Executive Officer?
Thank you for asking. No, I shared all my updates at the top of the workshop, so nothing else from me.
Well, then, in closing, I'd like to remind everybody the holiday season. And there are people in need. There are food banks that could use your help. If you have the ability to donate, please donate. unused items, food and clothing. And with that, happy holidays. Meeting's adjourned.